Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning basement finishing system for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, when Purdue Pharma first started marketing OxyContin, it was sold as a cure for any and all pain. What they failed to mention was that it's also incredibly addictive. Now New England is in the throes of a tragic opioid crisis that has affected our healthcare system and our economy while devastating families throughout the region. So what's the answer to all this? From 11 to 12, Mayor Marty Walsh and others join us for an opioid summit where we'll explore what the city of Boston is doing and could do to help combat the crisis.
After we hear what Mayor Walsh thinks about the opioid crisis, we'll ask you what you think. Is there a policy you think the mayor should know about? Are you satisfied with the city and state's response to this epidemic? We'll open the lines to hear from you. That's on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Friday from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Good.
So while opioid-related overdose deaths in Massachusetts continue to go down slightly, the challenges of fighting this crisis have not. From saving lives to helping people in recovery start new ones, the reverberations of this epidemic are vast and varied, and they demand a multifaceted response. Today, we're hosting what we're calling an opioid summit, looking at how Boston is responding to the crisis. We're joined by Mayor Marty Walsh. Mr. Mayor, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
John McGann, who is CEO and president of the Gavin Foundation, which is a nonprofit specializing in addiction treatment and prevention. Good to meet you, John. Thanks for being
part of this.
We're also joined by Marty Martinez. Marty is the city's chief of health and human services. Again, welcome to you, Marty. Thanks so much for being here, all three of you. We're really excited about this. And by the way, during our hour-long discussion today, the mayor and his colleagues will be taking your questions and calls, your stories, whatever you want to share. You can tweet us at BOS Public Radio, send an email to bpr at wgbh.org, or call, which is the preferred route, 877-301-8970.
So we want to talk about solutions in a few minutes, you know, what we're doing in Boston, what we should be doing, what's difficult to do. But before we do that, just for people that don't know, what's the problem? What does opioid addiction mean right here in the city of Boston?
Let me just start real quickly, and then I'm going to turn it over to John McGann. Just quickly set the table. I met John McGann roughly around 1997. I was asked to serve on the board of the Gavin House, which is a halfway house for alcohol and drug addiction. But at the time in 97, alcohol was the primary issue that people dealt with or talked about publicly. I got a chance to understand what the Gavin House does as far as treating and having extended care for people. I really didn't learn about addiction until I went to treatment. And when I went to treatment, I learned about what addiction is, and it's a disease. It's a disease of the brain, and you know, you think of somebody who drinks too much or takes drugs that some people think that you can stop. It's not one of those things you can just stop. It's kind of like cancer that you need treatment for it. You need to be cured from it. You need follow up care. So I think what I want to kind of set the table here is just understanding what addiction is and what opioid disorder means. And I'm going to ask John maybe to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think the first thing we want to do is recognize that it affects everybody. It affects people of low income, medium income, high income, people of all races, all backgrounds, that there's nobody's safe from addiction. The other thing I think that we skip over a lot is the number of people that it affects, not just the person that it affects, but the ripple effect on families and businesses. And I think that we want to make sure that we get to that at some point today, that the human cost and the financial cost in the workplace as well, I think, is important to discuss. And what we have to realize is that many people get addicted to things not just through recreational use, but also through having injuries at work, you know, surgeries, things that, you know,
prescriptions.
Prescriptions that everybody does. And I often say, we have an adolescent program in South Boston called the Cushing House, and we've done probably 1,000 intakes since 1999. And I always say, you know, nobody's, when we do the intake, we ask them age of first use and drug of first use. And I can tell you that nobody comes in and says opiates is there.
And what,
first
Marty,
use.
Marty, what are the, I mean, but we should say the Office of Mayor's Office of Recovery Services mm-hmm. is in your jurisdiction, yep. Health and Human Services. Obviously, you're dealing with this every day. What are we talking about in terms of drugs? I mean, everybody yeah. can recite fentanyl and mm-hmm. opioids and stuff, but it's broader than that, is it not?
Yeah, it definitely is, and that's why I thought even though we're talking about it from an opioid epidemic, I mean, we're talking about you know, folks dealing with substance use disorders, and that continues to still be alcohol. It continues to be, and now what we see more, meth. On the street, people dealing with and using meth, heroin. So we talk about opioids because that's what's sort of in the news and what's front and center. But you know, what's come before and what's come after continues to impact folks every single day. So the reason that I think it's important to lift it up is that means it's complicated on how it plays out in the street, how it plays out in treatment programs, how it plays out in terms of what kinds of you know, resources people need and treatment beds. So it's definitely more complicated than the opioid itself or opioids as the epidemic. But that's why we really need to lift up how complex it is.
You know, because,
it's a disease of progression as well.
Yeah.
No one starts out being drug addicted or alcoholic the first day. You know, my alcoholism started with drinking a couple beers, and at first it wasn't, the trouble didn't happen, and over time it became a disease of progression, where you're drinking to kind of drown out the feelings, and you're drinking to excess. And everyone, at the end of the day, it's kind of like, I say this is an inside game, where the recovery comes into play is you know, you just defeated and devastated. Not everyone gets it either. So it is progression. So whether it's you know, opioids, somebody gets a prescription of Oxycontin or whatever it might be for their back or for their arm or for their leg or for their tooth, they take one or two, and then all of a sudden now it mounts into from Oxycontins to something else mm-hmm. to needle in the arm. And progresses from there. Now we're seeing fentanyl, crystal meth, all the other drugs on the street. Same for alcoholics. You know, anyone who's listening today, just what we'll say this a couple times, but anyone listening today, if you are looking for help, and you're listening to this story, listening to this radio show today, you can call 311 City of Boston. We will be there for you to help you. If you're outside of Boston and you want to call in, it's 617-635-4500.
You know, before we move to, I know John wanted to comment on this too. We have spoken to a lot of doctors, people who run programs around this. One of the first topics that comes up in terms of the current state of affairs is the stigma issue. And that while it's being addressed and maybe it's mitigated to some degrees, I have to say, we usually don't compliment you on your normal segments here, but let me just say, I'm amazed at how open you are. When you spoke at the Democratic National Convention, what was your opening line in that speech?
Yeah, I'm mighty an alcoholic.
So why do you do this?
Because it's important to be able to let people know if they need to get help. When I became a legislator in 97, you know, I quickly jumped to this issue, and I just felt Kevin Fitzgerald, who was the rep for Mission Hill, used to introduce himself as Kevin Alcoholic. I mean, I'm a politician, he'd say. And I thought that putting it out there allows two things. Number one, if people are looking for help, they'll come find me. And number two, understanding, and I wasn't really thinking of the stigma at the time, but the stigma of it as well, that in 97, even when I was on the Gavin board with the Cushing House, parents didn't want to tell people their kids were addicted. Families that lost loved ones would say they had a heart attack or some type of something going on. Over time, that's changed to some degree, and people are more open about their recovery, and people are more open about their families are more open about.
And that helps everybody else.
It does help everyone else because if you have that support network, and you're a parent and you're struggling, you don't know where to go. You know, you hear that there's a program called Learn to Cope. You hear there's a programs out there to help you, that you're not alone in this. Because I think a lot of times, alcoholism and drug addiction is isolation. It's a thing of isolation. You isolate, and you don't talk about it, and you kind of isolate, and the family isolates, and they don't want to talk about the problem in the other room. And I think by having it out there, you know that it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to address it, and it's okay to try and reach out, get the help you need to deal with it. Whether, like John said, whether it was the family disease, which it is, or it's the individual disease, it's really difficult. And I just think it's important.
By the way, we're going to take your calls. They are going to take your calls. 877-301-8970. Before you ask what you're going to ask, can you follow up on what the mayor just said? Because you have talked on the air repeatedly about how people have started in obituaries. But go ahead.
Well, I did a couple of stories when I was doing columns for the Globe about people that they started to say in their obituary of, it's often their child, 25, 28, 35, succumbed after a long battle with addiction. You know, when I wrote a story about a woman up in Salisbury Beach whose son was, she spent tens of thousands of dollars, and she was a middle-class woman, had a nice house in Salisbury, nice house in Massachusetts, too, and spent tens of thousands of dollars to get her son help. And she talked about how much he wanted to stop, how he was in rehab, and we're doing really well for 7 years, and then comes home to his old neighborhood, hooks up with his old buddies, gets high, and dies by accident. I mean, and he started this after an injury, like the mayor talked about. So as you talked about, John, you know, we know that there are people that are really struggling, that you see the people down by Mass Ave and Melnia Cass and stuff, but there's all sorts of people who are, I guess you could say, functioning. They're kind of going to work and kind of being parents, but they have this big, huge addiction problem. Middle class, upper middle class, wealthy people.
But I want to gloss over the original point. It's putting it in an obituary rather than saying my son died or daughter died after a long illness is another variation on what you have done, Mr. Mayor, is being honest and open.
Yeah, coming out of the closet.
And which I think does make a big difference dealing with a stigma issue.
Can I add a piece about the stigma
thing? Marty Martinez.
That I think is important, which is stigma about what we experience ourselves, but I also think the history of how we've dealt with addiction and drugs and crime, I think also stigmatizes how people think about it. And the reason I lift that up is I think, you know, in communities of color, we will often hear, you know, references to what had been, you know, the war on drugs and how we dealt with addiction in the past versus how we think about it today around a disorder and a disease. And so the reason I lift that up is I think it can also feel like we're battling stigma now, but we didn't really, the stigma then was sort of okay to say people that are facing those issues or those addictions, you know, those were bad people. That's why we had the frame we have. So I just think when we think about stigma, it really is the biggest barrier to getting people accessing care, and it comes in different forms in different communities.
Well, you know, since you brought that up, I was going to hold questions for a few minutes. We just got a tweet from a woman you were on my television show with last night, Professor Tina Opie from Babson, who asked a question, Marty Martinez, that relates to that. What happens to people with substance abuse problems who were historically criminalized, many still in prison? How do you address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's programmatic ways to address it, right? I mean, I think part of that is reaching people that are incarcerated through programs and services to help them get not only treatment there in within the House of Corrections, but also as they transition out into the community and connecting them to providers and services. I think it's really important. I think state data tells us that in mass, that people that are recently released from incarceration are much more likely to face an overdose or a fatal overdose. And so I think that's important. But I think this is exactly what I'm talking about. I think the fact that the criminalization of it then has created a whole notion that people feel like they can't get help because they got in trouble for it versus people getting the resources they need to find a different path. But again, I think it's all those pieces trying to figure out a better way forward.
You know, when we get to solutions in a minute, you just mentioned about treatment in prison, but we talked to Carol Rose, head of the Civil Liberties Union here, about a lawsuit they filed in December because the federal prison system is putting limits on opioid treatment, putting a 90-day sort of cold turkey kind of thing, seeming to me as a layperson totally misunderstanding the problem and the cure, John.
Well, I think the law here in the Commonwealth is that they recently passed last year was so that when somebody goes into incarceration, they have access to medicated-assisted treatment for the first 90 days to make sure that nobody is instantly detoxed and has withdrawal issues while they're going into incarceration, and then again, they have an opportunity to sign up for MAT 90 days prior to their release. So if people feel they need the extra...
What's that, MAT? What's that?
Medicated-assisted treatment. Okay. So it could be the Vivitrol, Suboxone, or methadone. So they're trying to have them access it 90 days prior to release.
So before we get to calls, we have calls, and we'll get to them in a second. Can we talk for a couple of minutes about what we are doing in Boston you may think things are working, not working. Obviously, we talked to you about the whole Melnia Cast situation, and there is a Melnia Cast 2.0, from what I understand, Mr.
Well,
Mayor.
Well, in 2014, we started the Office of Recovery Services. We're the first city in America to have an office like that. We started to make investments in counseling, make investments in treatment, make investments in getting people into treatment, really focusing on, rather than just kind of patchworking the situation, really, really taking a deep, comprehensive dive into addiction services for all of Boston. Melnina and Mass Ave is, people think it was created after the close of Long Island Bridge, that kind of what was going on down there. It was going on in that area long before Long Island Bridge closed, let's be honest, anytime we went down there. And the reason why there's so many people down there that are addicted, there's a couple reasons. Number one is Long Island Bridge adds to it. Closing of Long Island, losing the services on the island adds to it. The services that are there currently, there's a lot of detoxes, and you have the city hospital. You have health care for the homeless. You have methadone clinics. You have all the services that people are struggling in different ways, in different aspects of their life. They're struggling, so it attracts them to that area. And then you have people who just go there on a daily basis because they see other people there. And then you also have, in some cases, what we're trying to do this is weed out the drug dealers who are there as well, preying on people. So it's almost like a perfect, bad storm, but a perfect storm. That's happening down there. And you know, when John opened up his comment here, what we see in Melnina and Mass Ave is happening in individual homes all across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, across the country. Now, you might not see it because it's in somebody's home and they try to hide it, but it's happening all across. So it really is talking about, in the Office of Recovery Services, getting to the heart of the disorder, getting to the heart of the disease, getting to the heart of that, and how do we try and help people one person at a time get onto a road of recovery. And that's ultimately what our intention is. You know, we've added in the last, since 2014, I don't know, 25, maybe 20 counselors. We've added outreach workers in the street. We've increased our AHO program, which is detox. We work closely with the Gavin Foundation to get people into their detox, in their holding, in their halfway houses. We're working with other organizations and nonprofits. We're working with a whole bunch of different people. We're working with the state representative, John Santiago, who I was talking to earlier.
Who's also a doctor.
Who's a doctor. I mean, John is in his first term and has an understanding of the issue as an elected official now on how to deal with the issue, but he also understands it as a medical, a disorder, in the brain, in the development of the brain and the damage to the brain. So we're working with John, we're working with Aaron Mikowitz, who's a state rep from the North End, who's been helpful through the budget process, and a whole host of other folks. So we're going to constantly, you know, not to get off track here, but what you see out in the street is why I think we're here today talking about this issue, that the face of addiction is the people on the street, people in prison, people in recovery. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of us.
Can I just add to this piece for the mayor that, you know, to give you an example of that, every single week, and we track data and resources in terms of what we're doing, every single week the outreach team that the mayor's put in place, as well as the diversion team to the Boston Police Department, is referring roughly around 70 individuals every single week into some level of treatment in that neighborhood. And so it's important to think about that many people get referred into treatment many times. It takes many, many times for some folks to actually get on that better path. But to get one person into treatment is a long process, to build relationships on the street, to build connections with them, to have them trust you, and to have them connect to a resource like the Gavin Foundation or others who are going to be able to connect with them.
So and it's want to go in.
And want to go in. Right.
Well,
of the things that you read about alcoholism, which you would know about, Mr. Mayor, that you kind of have to get to a rock bottom point where you've
I didn't want to go to detox, okay? I didn't want to go. I didn't want to make the phone call to go to detox. My boss forced me to make the phone call.
Because you didn't
want
to
stop?
My job
was on the
line.
I didn't think I need to go. Oh, I didn't want to go. When I went down to detox, I didn't want to drive down the Gosnell. When I got to the front door, I didn't want to walk in. When I walked in and I sat with the nurse, I didn't want to go to the back room. And when I was sitting in there, I was thinking, what am I doing in here with a bunch of alcoholics and drug addicts? And it was that night a commitment came in, a group of people who expressed their experience, strength, and hope. And something hooked me that night. and I realized maybe I'm in the right place. And then, and the next day when I went into treatment, and that we sat down and talked about treatment and addiction and the disease and the mental craving, the physical obsession, all of that, I learned about all that there. And I learned about what yets are and things like that. And I said to myself, that resistance I had 24 hours prior to that, it was a little different in there. And when I got out after 7 days, they suggested things I do. And I did the suggestions because I didn't want to go back. And it was difficult. And it was difficult for a while because you have to change. You're changing as a human being. And you have to change. You got to think about
friends.
This now. Your friends are all drinking with you. Your friends are all using with you. Your whole world is at Melnin and Mass Ave. Your whole world is the bar you drink at. Your whole world is in the room you use in. And you don't think there's another way of life. And over time, slowly but surely, piece at a time, you realize that your life's different. And then you fast forward, you know, years later. And when you talked about the prison situation, I know people personally that went into prison, went into Walpole State Prison, addicted human beings, and today they're working, they have a family, they bought a house, they have a car, they have a life, all of that stuff, because they were able to some point they were fortunate enough to get the recovery component of addiction.
Yeah, I'm going to say one more related thing, though, if I can, and then we're going to get to the calls because the lines are full. John, this is really for you. Is I can't tell you how many calls Marjorie and I have had over the last decade. And you've heard them, all of you, much more than we, from a mother who said, my kid was ready. I couldn't find a bed. All I did was I spent 24/7 trying to find a place for my son who was finally at the point, and I just couldn't do it. And often those stories ended with horrible sadness. We are still short on that front, despite the best of intentions, are we not?
Yeah, so when we talk about beds, there's different levels of beds. Mm-hmm. So the first entry for most people, not all, is detox or acute treatment services, and that's a 24/7 medical unit. We now have enough of those beds in the Commonwealth.
We do.
What we don't have is the long-term step-down. And a lot of folks feel that the step-down beds are too expensive to have out there, but to the mayor's point, if somebody's whole world is somewhere where everybody's active and they don't have any other social supports, you have to remove them from that and put them in a safe, supportive environment, and that's where the long-term residential recovery homes can really play a role in keeping people off the streets and into recovery.
Let's go to the phone calls.
Before we go to the phones, the mayor will pick them in a second, but can you give us the Long Island update? Because you broached it before. And
this is where Long Island comes in. Mm-hmm. We are building a comprehensive campus on Long Island, but it is about long-term beds as well, and that's where this comes in. And I think that when you think about somebody who goes into treatment, some people need the halfway house. And I didn't go to a halfway house. I jumped right into the treatment. But I know people that need the long-term treatment. And if the bed's not available, I've called John before, and I'll say, John, I have somebody looking to get into treatment. What's the list like? He'll say 10 people before him, or I'll call Judy McDonough down the Edwina Martin House in Brockton, and she'll say, there's 7 women before her. And that 7 women, that means that person has to go to holding. And if that person's in holding for 10 weeks, they're probably not going to stay there.
Right.
And what happens now, they think they can do it on their own. They go back out, go back home. They return right back to where they were, and they're not ready for that.
Who pays for the long-term beds?
The state pays for some of them, and then some of them can be
insurance?
Privately paid.
Right.
Insurance. Insurance doesn't really pay for them.
Well, MassHealth pays for the residential.
But if you're not on MassHealth, then you got to hope that your insurance pays for it, or you got to shell out the money.
If somebody's uninsured, the Department of Public Health will pay.
Okay, but if they're insured, you hope you get something from Blue Cross or Pilgrim or whatever it is.
So I view Long Island as an opportunity to be a therapeutic community. It's on the water. People would go to work. People that go to the Gavin House go to work. And we want to build a bridge to allow people the opportunity to have that long-term care. Where we are in the process, real quick, we can talk about it next time on the radio. We're working through the DEP to get permits, and we're also working through, we have, I think, one court case still left.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hopeful that we're going to be successful. We are planning the bridge. The money's in the budget. We're designing the bridge.
Are you talking to the mayor of Quincy at all?
We talk very indirectly about it. I mean, a lot of what the mayor The mayor has a couple communities that put pressure that they don't want it. I wish they would just like think about it. Anyone in the areas of Quincy, like Squanum and other places, you know, I know there are people in recovery in those neighborhoods. We're not looking to create a manufacturing site there where there's going to be thousands of cars every day. We're looking to put long-term recovery beds, people reclaiming their life.
So can I make a suggestion here if we can? We have a lot of calls. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll not only get to the phone calls, but we'll also talk about other solutions in the pipeline that may have some challenges that maybe we can deal with.
Okay, we are going to take a break, but we are talking about the opioid crisis with Mayor Marty Walsh, John McGann, and Marty Martinez. We're going to take your questions and calls. We promise, as soon as we come back, you're listening to 89.7 WGBH from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Regan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're hosting a special. Well, we're calling it an opioid summit, but it's beyond opioids. With Mayor Marty Walsh, John McGann, President and CEO of the Gavin Foundation, Marty Martinez. Marty is the city's Chief of Health and Human Services. We're now going to get to your calls. The number is 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor, why don't you take one?
Rachel, our first call. Rachel Sedbury.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, everybody. Jim and Marjorie, I love your program.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for all you do.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I am a parent coach for parents whose kids struggle from substance use disorder. And I work, I volunteer through the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids, which is online, drugfree.org, and it's 855-DRUG-FREE. And anyone can call free, and they can, parents, and parents can talk to hotline support about their kids who are struggling. And then they can also get parent coaching support from people like me who have experienced my child struggling with substance use disorder. And I can help parents to fight the shame and stigma that's so associated and keeps parents and families so isolated with this disease. And so I just wanted to put that out there.
Rachel, what's the number to call? So if parents are listening, they want to help, get some help.
Yes, it's 855-DRUG-FREE, 855-378-4373.
Thank you, Rachel.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Rachel, for calling in.
Let's go to Jody in the car.
Hi, Jody.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about compassion just a little bit. That's what all addicts need. And there's this common idea that comes up from people who don't understand addiction of addicts making their bed and now they should lay in it as if they deserve this misery. And there's two things I want to say about that. First of all, there's a whole chunk of people who are addicted who never made a bad choice or had a moral failure. You know, they were taking their prescription as prescribed or whatnot. But even so, you know, we've got to have compassion for everyone. Everyone in their lives has made a mistake that could put them in danger. And addiction works the same way. You know, you can end up in an environment or even just make one mistake that leads you where you're going. It doesn't mean you're not worthy of compassion. And when it comes to food stamps, it doesn't mean you're not worthy of food. Or your kids shouldn't get food. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Jody, thank you.
Thank you guys for having this confirmation.
Thank you. Any reflections on that, gentlemen? Anybody want to comment or just go to the next call?
I think a lot of people, I mean, are eligible for certain services as well. So we try to connect them to the services that they're out there. So I appreciate that. Ellen in the car.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have a question, and I might be completely wrong, but I was under the impression that doctors, like your primary, couldn't prescribe methadone or Suboxone if you were addicted. Am I correct? You have to go to a facility?
You have to go to a facility for methadone. For Suboxone, primary care physicians and psych NPs who have been waivered, taken a class and been waivered to prescribe it, can prescribe it from their primary care office, as well as Vivitrol can be administered in primary care as well. It's just the methadone that you have to go to a clinic.
But there also should be a component of like programming with that as well. So you're not just taking the pill, but you're understanding about why you're taking the pill, what's going on with you. And that's one of the things I think that sometimes doesn't happen across the board. It does happen, but I remember Suboxone, if you go to a Suboxone clinic, there's a component of counseling with that. And I think that that's key to it as well. you know, because it does work. I mean, there's no question it works. All of these, if somebody's not putting a needle around, there used to be a probation officer at Selty Court. There was a move at the State House years ago to eliminate methadone, and I was kind of for it because I thought it was just chaotic. And this guy, Jack Larry, court officer, probation officer, grabbed me and gave me an education really quickly, saying that I would much prefer to have somebody weeding off of heroin than putting a needle in their arm and causing crime or dying. And it made me think a little bit differently, a little more openly about it. And I think that on this on the medical assisted treatment, I don't think it's the only way to go, but I think it's definitely something we should be using.
Ellen, thanks for the call. You know, can we stay on the prescription thing for a minute? Another calls we've gotten on the other extreme is when the state put some limit on first prescriptions, and there was all the talk that gentlemen and women like you have had. People have called and said for their loved ones who do need these kinds of drugs that so many doctors are now gun-shy because of the regulations, because of a whole variety of things. What do we do? You're nodding in agreement, John, that it's an issue. What do we do about this?
Well, we hear that as well, and I think it's a balance, and it's unfortunate that it's come to this, but when there were so many pills out on the street, the Commonwealth had to do something to try to rein in who was prescribing it, how many they were prescribing at a time. We have to look at some of the crime that could have gone along with that, for example.
Oh, but by the way, let me just interrupt. They're not complaining about what the state did. They're saying because of what the state did in this whole big debate, doctors are pulling back even further than they legally have to because of the whole, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're trying to make sure that they're not over-prescribing to their patients and want to see them more frequently to make sure that the level of pain and the level of medication they're giving them is appropriate and to make sure that they're not getting the innocent person, so to speak, addicted. I mean, you know, we talked earlier about people suffer injuries, get put on the medication, and become addicted. If they're giving somebody too long of a prescription, then that's the risk you run. And I don't think that we want to think that it can't happen to the elderly who's, right, you know, shut it in. It can happen to them as well. So I think that the doctors are being responsible.
Does the average doctor have the training that they need to deal with this issue?
Up until 2014, there was no real training process for addiction. Now, some medical schools say we did it, but there really wasn't. There was a piece of legislation that went through the legislature. The governor filed it. The legislature passed it. That has now a component of disorder or addiction. The explaining to doctors the complexity and the addiction that's caused by some of the opioids. So the training's there now. It wasn't prior to 2014. There was no official training. There might have been individual training going on, but it wasn't across the board. Today now, per the legislature and the governor's office, there's training going on.
Marty Martinez, you were shaking your head. You're going to disagree with the boss over
No. No. But what I was going to say is that still today we hear hospitals say that although primary care physicians can get a waiver to be able to administer MAT, that they still don't get folks who want to do it. And I think there's a correlation between if you're in medical school and got very little training on how to prescribe and what does it mean to help someone dealing with a substance use disorder, then you're going to be weary about now what you see and kind of what you can provide. So even today, we have even community health centers who will say, we have one doctor who's willing to prescribe, but that's not enough to actually give enough people the care that they need.
By the way, the voices you hear for this special hour at the Boston Public Library is obviously the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh. John McGann is the president and CEO of the Gavin Foundation, and Marty Martinez, the voice you most recently heard, is the chief of health and human services for the city of Boston.
Mr. Mayor, before you get back to the call, just one quick question. I know you've got a Narcan, I think, in every public safety vehicle in the city, which is a great thing.
So we actually have training now in City Hall, so a lot of our team in City Hall, I think department heads and a lot of people are trained in Narcan.
But I know you've been in favor, I think you weren't in favor, but now you are in favor of these safe injection sites that can prevent people from dying?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I was at a meeting one night, and somebody was talking about their journey in recovery. And the person just said, well, they weren't talking about safe consumption sites. They were talking about just any entry point into recovery is an entry point into recovery. And that hit me very differently, and I started thinking about safe consumption sites. And, you know, we went up to Canada. Marty Martinez and myself went up there, and we started looking at the different facilities in Canada. And the thing that jumps out at you is that they've never had a death of an overdose of somebody using inside one of these facilities. Now, not everyone's gotten to treatment either, but they've never had a death. And the obituaries you talked about earlier, no mothers had to write one. And I think that, you know, we should be looking at every opportunity as a potential entry point into recovery. And the safe consumption sites are one of those opportunities. I mean, you know, there are people, and I'm one of them as well. When Suboxone first came, I was kind of like, well, I don't know. Well, you should go the abstinence way and go to treatment and things like that. It doesn't work for everybody. I mean, everyone's different. Everyone's recovery is different. Everyone's entry point's different. And I looked at that as an opportunity. And I think that, you know, everyone's saying, oh, we don't want them. Before you say you don't want them, let's take a look at them and see exactly what it means. And I think that, you know, there's still work to be done. They're still illegal in the federal government. They're not legal in Massachusetts either, or any state in Massachusetts in America. So we have to really think about it. But it's been successful in Canada, and it's been successful in some European countries. So I think if it's working there, why wouldn't we look at something, how what's working?
We should just put it in context quickly before we move on to the next call. Is the governor's not yet convinced that this is the right idea? And as you mentioned, Andrew Lelling, the U.S. attorney from Massachusetts, has made it clear that, as of the moment, as you said, it is against federal law, he contends, and he will not tolerate in any case. That's the current state of affairs. Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayo.
Let's go to Mendez in Foxborough.
Hey, Mendez. Hello, Mendez. I think it's our fault. Can we get to Mendez on that line there, please, back in Brighton?
I guess
are
not.
We having technical problems, people? We got to know.
Go.
Mendez, you're on. Thank you. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Mendez. Our fault. Hi, Mendez.
Hey, Ursula, how are you doing today?
Great.
I'm trying to make two points here. So first is the stigma and the shame of the drug addiction. Nobody really understands. Like, at the end of the day, people go into drugs in every type of way, not knowing the true consequence of it. But once you do decide to clean yourself up, you go into these halfway houses or treatment programs. When you come out, you have nowhere to go. So you're going to end up right back on that staff. And, like, it's more than just treatment. It's what's the treatment after the fact, after you get treated? Like, housing, for example, where, like, they have nowhere to go afterwards. So they're going to end up on that staff regardless.
Let's have the mayor and others, if they choose, respond. Mr. Mayor?
Well, I think, you know, there's definitely some issues with what's going on with the housing crisis and finding housing to go. But for all intents and purposes, when you go into treatment and you go into a halfway house, you should be working with the counselors there. And again, I'll speak for John for a minute, the Gavin Foundation. They'll set you up. But while you're in treatment, you're getting a job. And while you're getting a job, you're rebuilding your life. And after you're done with your stay at the Gavin Foundation, there's an opportunity to go to a step-down program, or there's an opportunity to maybe take the next step. And I think that it's about working the program. And I think that at some point in your recovery, you're on your own, but you have to take responsibility for who you are as a human being. And I think that that's why the longer-term treatment is key to success. Again, there's no playbook to how this works. It's different for everybody. And I mentioned the story of the person coming out of prison, out of Walpole, that had no place to go, got into treatment, I think went to the Gavin House, went somewhere into a halfway house in Boston, and then was able to get a job, and was able to get a permanent job, was able to get his daughter back in his life, was able to buy a home down the road. And I think it's about rebuilding a life.
But to follow up on Mendez, Mr. Mayor, I'm sure there are some people who need more support.
No question.
In those moments. And is that there, John? Yeah. Or?
So it is there. So most recovery homes, long-term programs, will have caseworkers and counselors that will work with people while they're there. Part of the services that we will refer people to if we don't provide them is employment counseling, job training programs like the Access to Recovery, the Building Pathways. There's a slew of training programs out there, Pine Street, mm-hmm. et cetera, where we try to get people employable while they're in the program, mm-hmm. allow them to save money while they're there. They can then go into a lot of programs, have graduate houses they can go to. And then there's certified sober homes that people can go to, and they all – Once they're at that point, they will have be hooked up to insurance, MassHealth insurance, and they'll have access to a recovery coach who can help them through the transitional phase and as they leave formal treatment and go into more self-help?
For the average person, if I may, either the individual themselves who needs the treatment or a family member, loved one, who is overwhelmed by the whole thing, which I assume almost everybody is, are there navigators either within the Office of Recovery Services or at the Gavin Foundation or wherever where they can talk to you about all the elements of this thing rather than you having to fish around by yourself? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the Office of Recovery Services is putting that together. But once you get into the treatment piece of it, it's incumbent upon the programs that they go into to help them. But let's just, as Mendez talked about, just people listening, not everyone. I think when my first group I had in detox, they asked us to describe the alcoholic. And what we all described was a person drinking out of a brown paper bag, a homeless person. That's not just the alcoholic. I mean, there are folks that go into treatment that have a job. They have a family. They have a life. They have all that stuff. And they've lost it over time, which means that if they're able to get into the recovery side of it, most times that all comes back. And you don't feel it at that particular moment. You don't see it at that moment, but it all comes back. So not every single person that's going into recovery needs food stamps, needs public assistance, needs a job, needs training. They have it. They need to rebuild their life. And I think that – so the addiction is so much more than what people view an addict or somebody suffering out there.
Marty, you want to add something?
No, the only thing I was going to add is that something that we're that John McGann and the Gavin Foundation are working with the recovery services on is this STEP pilot. And the reason I lift it up is I think it's an example of exactly, to the mayor's point, as part of even our Mass and Cast plan, the STEP pilot sort of does that. It gives someone like the ability to navigate through the entire, like, you may be on the street, how do we get you to that first step of what it is to get treatment or care? How do we wrap ourselves around you, like case management? Do you need job training? Working to ensure that we might find you employment while we're also helping you navigate a service provider for housing? You know, we're also talking about, and John mentioned this, we're talking about lots of different providers throughout this. We're not talking about one entity usually doing all of it. So, and even in that, we're working in collaboration, but as you can imagine, getting from someone from off the street to actually into a job and with usable skills, it takes a lot of coordination and a lot of support. But again, that's only one group of folks battling substance use disorder. There are many other folks that are in different situations doing it, but that's a part of the work that we're doing in collaboration.
And are the numbers the mayor gave before, the 311 and 635-4500, or 617 number, those are the entry points for the kinds of things you're talking about in the city?
That's the main number, City Hall. The people you call there for anything you want, but if you have an addiction question or you have a family member suffering or you're suffering yourself, you call those numbers. We will then connect you to a counselor.
Fine. Let's go back to the phones, Mr. Mayor.
Claudia in the car.
Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
We can. Yes.
Hi. So I just wanted to say I think this program is great. I graduated from Marathon House in 1974, so I've been clean, 40 years?
Congrats.
So one of the things that baffles me is that why can't there be places like Marathon House that were here in the 70s? They had 7 houses. They were a therapeutic community. They graduated up to 20 people a year, and a lot of those people are clean. I mean, I run a multi-million-dollar company. One of my people I was there with was the CFO of Citibank, his assistant district attorney in Springfield. There was a lot of successful people, but it was a 3-year program. You had first stage, second stage, and third stage. You know, recently I had to put my son into treatment, and I was appalled. I couldn't find a place. He ended up in some place in New Hampshire that was terrible. And now he's sitting home. He can't find a job. He, you know, is with Mass Rehab, but they don't really help too much. So my question is, what happened to those therapeutic communities we used to have back in the 70s, number one? And number two, as a parent, how do you get, when you're in crisis and you need to find a place, where do you call to find a place? It was mind-baffling to not be able to find a treatment place.
Yep. Gentlemen.
John, thank you for the call, Claudia.
Thank you, Gordon.
On the second part of your question, I'm going to let John answer the first part. In Boston, if you live in Boston, you call 635-4500 or you call 311. And we changed in 2015. We realized that parents didn't know where to turn to. Well, we knew that before that. But we didn't have a hotline in the city of Boston. We have one out today. And we'll connect you to AHOPE, which is a program that we have. And then we have providers that we work with to get people into treatment.
John.
In the Commonwealth, statewide, if you go to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health Bureau of Addiction Services helpline, They have a navigator there that can help you find everything from detox to long-term programs, outpatient programs, and it'll tell you whether or not it's publicly funded or private funded. So I would suggest that you go to that site. And as far as the long-term programs, what's happened is I believe it's mostly driven by cost and capacity. Unfortunately, if you can turn a bed over in 6 months opposed to a year, then you can essentially intake twice as many people. So when we look at the number of people seeking services, we've been forced to, you know, shorten the length of stay and try to get as many people into treatment and get them on the path to recovery and then hopefully conduct a warm handoff to somebody in the community that will help them with community service.
Claudia, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
You know, one of the things, you see these ads on TV, the Globe did a series about this, places that are advertising recovery services, and they're on some beautiful beach in Florida or something, and then they were talking about how they really weren't doing such a great job at these places. So that's a problem, too, figuring out where to go, right?
And what's real and what's a fraud.
Because you can pay tens of thousands of dollars, and you're not at a great place. What do you do?
I think you use the resources at your fingertips that people don't realize that are there. Not enough people understand that, whether it's the state line or the city line, to find out, even if you have a question on a program that you want to send your child to or somebody or you want to go to, just call the city or state and let's see what's going on. You know, there's some great programs outside the Commonwealth. There's some great programs here. But I would always tell parents, I mean, I've talked to plenty of parents that have paid, you know, the tens of thousands of dollars to send their kid somewhere else and it didn't work out for them. I always tell them, like, try and get somebody who understands, even if you call a place in Massachusetts, just to ask questions. I think a lot of people will be open to giving you input and ideas on what's out there, what's not out there.
Well, let's go back to the calls.
Albert in Framingham.
Hello, Albert.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to first say thank you for providing the service to us so we know what's going on in our state. And as a veteran, I have some concerns being over in Afghanistan and having some of our NATO allies protecting some opiate fields and burning down others. So I see a point of vested interest. And then you guys talked about an article a while back how we had insurance companies bringing in people from other states to receive treatment. But my question is, do we have the infrastructure to do that, and who's profiting on this? Is it the insurance companies that are having these, what I would call a heroin broker, bringing people in from other states?
Wow. Albert,
because I love the idea of being a Commonwealth state, but I feel like we're being taken advantage of a little bit through the insurance companies if we're bringing people in and using our tax dollars to help them.
Let's get John to answer the question. John?
So very good question, and that goes back to capacity and when we talk about different types of beds. So first, it's not the insurance companies that are creating that. That is private enterprise that's allowed to come into the Commonwealth and open up a facility because there's no determination of need. Anybody can come in, they can get it cited, they can get a license, and they can open up a program, and those being funded through private insurances, but they might not even be Commonwealth insurance companies. It could be insurance companies from Pennsylvania, North Dakota, you know, wherever across America. They can fly them in and send them in. So it's not really, a lot of those private ones might not be serving Massachusetts people. The issue that they really create is a workforce shortage for programs that are here that are designed to take care of the people in the Commonwealth. So that's something that we want to keep an eye on.
Albert, thank you much for the call. We only have a couple of minutes left. Could we go down the line, starting with you, Marty? What's the one thing on your agenda, or at least on your list of things, that you think could have the most major impact that we haven't quite gotten there? You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
The thing, and forget politics just for a second.
Okay.
You know, that what would really make a difference?
So I'll leave Long Island just out there because
okay,
we know
fine.
That
okay.
That was talked about, but I think that would make a huge difference. I think the thing that is making a difference and will continue to make a difference is really fully wrapping ourselves around individuals and not just assuming that Our system's not seamless right now, so people are not easily able to access one level of care to the next level of care to the next level without extra supports. And so we've started doing that on a really small basis from getting you off the street into those sort of pathways to care. We've started, but it's small, and I think that's where we're making progress. You know, it's complex. One person's story is as complex as anyone else's. So to do that, I think, and scale it is a big deal. We right now have the largest outreach team focused in the city. The city has that team. And so we're on the street working that every day, and I think we just need to keep doing that to get more people into care.
How about you, John?
So first, I'd like to say that the city is doing a great job trying to outreach to people and get them in. We have to understand that there's a difference between need and want. And so there's many people that need treatment. There's even less that want it, and the city's outreach team is doing a heck of a job really trying to drag people in. So that's one. The second thing is we have to understand that this is a disease of isolation. Mm-hmm. So how do we, as the chief mentioned, wrap people around, get them all the services they need? But we have to understand that many of these folks are very depressed, and some of it's situational depression. I mean, their life isn't going well. So how do we help them get job training, get jobs, get the things they need? Everybody wants to feel good. Everybody's basically looking at them like they're bums, and that's how they feel. And we need to be able to help lift them up and see their self-worth and carry them to the next step if we have to. But they can get there, but they need our support. And I think those wraparound things are very important. We would like to reach out to employers if you're going to be employer-friendly and to people in recovery. I'm sure the mayor's office would be happy to handle those calls and share
Thanks,
it with those of us that are placing them.
Yeah, so before you sound like Jim Browdy now.
Before we get to the mayor to finish it up, what his on his the reason I was smiling at you when you said there's a difference between need and want, when Andy Card was with us, former state rep in Massachusetts, who went on to become chief of staff to George W. Bush, we were talking to him. You probably don't remember this, Marjorie. And I said, when everybody comes and says they need a meeting, what did you say with the President of the United States? And his response was, I would say there is a difference between need and want. Which, but Mr. Mayor, what's the top item on your agenda?
It's investment. You know, this what we're dealing with today has been going on for forever with addiction. The opioid crisis added, fast-tracked the heroin addiction in this country. Hundreds of billions of dollars was sold and made in this industry, and we're fighting it with tens of millions of dollars. So it's about investment. Everything we talked about today, whether it's Long Island, whether it's about further treatment, whether it's about getting people into treatment, it's about investment. And when you look at, and John won't say this, and he's never complained to me about this, at least in the last 5 or 6 years, but when I was on the board, the Gavin Foundation, the Gavin House, the amount of reimbursement was pennies to compare to the treatment that was given to somebody. So if we want to treat this correctly, we need to make investments. We need to invest in our people. We need to invest in the people that are sick and suffering, and that's the bottom line. Also, we need insurance companies to have treat this like every other disease, and have, you know, if somebody's diagnosed with cancer, the insurance company pays for everything to get that treatment. When somebody has addiction, sometimes they're put in detox for 5 days. That's not going to do it. We need to have better programs for insurance companies as well.
Gentlemen, we want to thank you all. We really, really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. And apologies we didn't get to all the calls and emails, but we've been speaking with Mayor Marty Walsh, John McGann, President and CEO of the Gavin Foundation, and Marty Martinez, the city's Chief of Health and Human Services. Mayor Walsh, John, and Marty, thank you very, very much for coming in. Up next, we're going to talk to Emily Rooney, famous list of fixations and fulminations. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, when the Encore Casino opened, Everett's mayor said it was the key to the economic resurgence of the city. Well, after the MGM Springfield posted its worst monthly earnings ever, should Massachusetts reconsider its love affair with casinos? The last Boston Globe business columnist, Shirley Young. Then last week, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley visited MCI Norfolk. We'll ask her what she learned during the visit and why she's pushing for an overhaul of the American criminal justice system. She'll also discuss her video that is the talk of the nation.
After the hashtag of Oscars so white, some hoped the future would be better. Well, not so. The 2020 Oscar nominees are overwhelmingly white and male. Is there a problem in Hollywood? We'll hear what Callie Crossey thinks when she joins us. Then the tables are reversed when Ginny Nightshade and Mike D'Angelo, the hosts of the Old School Game Show, see if they have what it takes to win our weekly news quiz. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Two little programming notes. I mentioned this just a couple of seconds ago. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley will join us in about 45 minutes, not only to talk about her criminal justice reform bill, but about a video she made for The Root that is being talked about all across this country.
Yeah,
she will describe it to us. And second programming announcement is I have a gift for you, Emily Rooney, our guest.
I almost brought you
okay,
one.
Okay, here it is. This is here with us at the library for her famous list of fixations and fulminations and more is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights right here on GBH2 at 7 o'clock. What I'm holding, by the way,
it's a fixation
is
of mine.
A sumo orange,
yes.
Which is not only the best orange ever, and it only costs like $2 a piece.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Thank you,
Jim.
Actually,
you're
it's
welcome.
So funny because I saw them yesterday in Whole Foods, and I said,
"Me too, first one."
And you can only get them like 8-10 weeks a year, and it's
fabulous.
Right now through early March, maybe if you're
they
lucky.
They are good.
Overpriced,
no seeds,
but great.
They are overpriced.
I'm obsessed,
but they
fixated.
Are.
Thanks, Jim.
Great to see you.
They are
worth it. So many people were like stunned a couple of nights ago to get a Amber Alert when an 11-year-old girl up in Springfield was pushed into the back seat of a car as she was screaming for help, and the went online. We learned about the car that the guy was driving and everything else. So this, tell us about this couple from Springfield who got the Amber
Alert. So the whole
alert.
Thing was really interesting. I mean, first of all, did you guys get the Amber
Alert?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
But mine came late, like 7:20 or something, because I was playing paddleball, and everybody's phone went off, and it was kind of, but I think that was when they caught them about that time.
No, it was, well, I don't know. I heard got it earlier.
Late at night.
Plus,
oh,
it was
I
on the radio
one.
Like nonstop.
So anyway, you know, the state police, everybody had put out a description of the car, and somebody had a photo of the car because somebody took a picture when this guy was going by this little girl. So this couple is on the highway, and one of them turns to the other and say, "Hey, isn't that the car that the picture you showed me of?" And then they look, and it's missing its front license plate. It's a blue Honda. It's got tinted windows. And they start following this person. Then they realize how suspiciously the person is acting. Then they really don't give up. They follow him to a parking lot, and then he jumps a little median divider to get out of their way. And then they eventually do lose him. Otherwise, I think it would have been borderline dangerous for them to continue any further. But they called the whole thing in, and before you know it, the police have them. I mean, you'd like to think
they gave the cops a license plate,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
that was
their
huge.
Number.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd like to think you would do the same thing, but could you? Could you?
Well, the guy, we got a little sound from the wife. We're going to hear it in a second. But the husband said, "I've been racing cars my entire life. I know how to drive. I push that truck to the absolute
I know,
absolute
but it's
limits.
Everybody else you worry about because
you
don't want to hurt somebody else.
And,
yeah, exactly.
Else. We should play a little sound. This is the wife in the situation, Springfield's Amanda Disley, and her husband, Benny Correa. They live streamed this whole thing, and here she is talking about their high-speed pursuit of the kidnapper.
I'm on Homestead Ave. They're turning. They're pulling by the building, a liquor store. They're trying to lose me. They're trying to ditch me. The kidnapper.
There's a kidnapper.
Yes, it's him. It's him. No, this is a blue Honda Civic, and they're doing 100 miles an hour right now. I'm passing. They're doing 100 miles an hour.
He just blew through a red light.
He's blowing through red light.
By the way,
he's blowing through
That's how typical husband and wife. They repeat what the other one said, right?
You know? And they couldn't script it. Andy. I know. And by the way, you know, it's great in the Globe story by Dugan Arnett, and I think it's Gay Zipperman Lotan. I probably pronounced one of those names wrong. They're talking about this. The woman, Amanda Disley, says, yeah, I mind my own business. I don't mind my own business,
but this is
different.
And they
it's
start talking
kids.
About their children exactly. and how protective they are of their
yeah,
children.
Yeah, they don't want the kids get their teeth clean without standing in the room with, yeah. with the hygienist. They're very protective, but good for them. I mean,
and apparently this guy had tried to do the same thing just a couple
to another,
months earlier.
Another
so,
girl.
I mean, you know,
dangerous
it sounds
guy.
Like he's got huge problems. Not that I'm sympathetic to him at all, but, you know, he's schizophrenic, off his meds, whatever. And
yeah.
Like, you know.
But the girl said the guy had a knife and was threatening
yeah, exactly.
her. So they may have saved this kid's life
exactly.
because of their courage. So
she, and that couple
the two of them.
Also could tell that there was somebody in the backseat of the car, even through the tinted windows, which is how they knew. So, you know, it wasn't because there was a sole driver in the front who was in the back, you know.
Exactly. No, yeah. it's a great story. If you haven't seen it, it's in the Globe.
It's really well
done.
And
you can read the whole thing from beginning to end. Speaking
so
of
excited, my orange.
Speaking of police officers.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited about this. Everyone knows that the state police have been plagued by problems, bogus overtime, you know, destroying records, fraud over there. I've always thought, and apparently I'm very happy the governor apparently thinks so too, that one of the problems is they've always had to hire from within. So it's very difficult.
The boss, you mean?
The boss of the state police has to be hired
the
from within.
Colonel
the state police.
Has yeah. to be hired.
So
yeah.
it is very difficult to ride herd on the people that you've
yeah.
been working
so,
with for 20 and 30 years. And he's trying to.
I think he has to go through the legislature to do that, which is problematic. But I so support this 100%. You know, I got on the phone today with the state police because I was just curious. You know how I've been critical of them in the past. Do you know how many state troopers there are?
Nope.
I had no idea. So there's like 2,145, about 83 of them are on leave like now. So that's about normal. But, I mean, their main mission is really traffic and murder. So they investigate every murder in every city and town except Boston, Worcester, Springfield, and Pittsfield. That they're in charge of every other murder investigation. But it's a hybrid when you think about it. And I always feel like things are overstaffed and, you know, if there's a construction site, there's always three state troopers there instead of one. It's like, it feels like a very bureaucratic. And just one, getting back to your point, if you have somebody else in charge there that isn't like looking out for, you know, their buddies and everything, but is looking at it more economically, more efficiently, and as somebody who isn't necessarily one of them, I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and it's also, they got big problems with women and minorities. They're 89% white and 95% yeah. male. So I think that's really in this day
I mean,
and
isn't
age,
that just how you picture a state trooper? I mean, that's
well,
just,
yeah,
that's
but it
just
it.
I don't think I've ever seen an African-American state trooper.
Well, I probably
have. I have a few.
Yeah. Have you met a few, Jim?
No,
in
I've
what capacity?
Met more than a few. Can I make a couple of comments about this? I am glad he did this. And by the way, the governor's bill does not just do the thing that Marjorie was talking about ad nauseum. In fact, you've discussed it with the governor on the show, that they'd be able to hire from outside. There are a bunch of other reforms
yep.
that make sense.
Yes.
There are a couple of caveats here, though. The current colonel's predecessor, we discussed this with the governor, too. I don't think he agreed, was not exactly transparent. Their biggest problem, I think, is they shouldn't just have to be called by the likes of you.
Mm-hmm.
At major moments, they have to be out there in the public answering questions and be accountable.
Completely agree.
She was not. Let's hope this new one is. Number two, I'll quote
you. Proactively accountable.
I agree. And I think this is where you were going a minute ago when you said that could be a problem. Here's the headline on a September 30th, 2019 story in the Boston Globe by Matt Ruscello. Mass State Police is plagued with scandal. Lawmakers' response? Question mark. Crickets.
Yeah,
they're scared
That's
to death
a great
of them.
Point. They're
and so
afraid
Baker
of them.
May file a bill that would move things in the right direction. We'll have the governor here next Thursday,
yeah.
the 23rd. We'll ask him. There is no historical
but
evidence that the Beacon
they,
Hill's ready
well,
to handle this.
Well, historically, remember the old MDC, the Metropolitan
sure.
District, that they used to patrol Storrow Drive. Remember that?
Sure.
They had a whole other police department for Storrow Drive and a couple of other. So they got rid of that. So. They can change.
Of course they can, but
well,
they have to
I
decide.
Think, I think that they're, in general, quite afraid of police unions in general. Because when you try to do something like maybe say that we don't actually need to have three state troopers for like a pothole, you know, you'll have the cops will descend and they'll show up by and they'll say, you know, they're very wired. They're a very wired union, a very powerful union. But this is crazy. I mean, I pity the poor person, who comes in.
Her,
the first head who comes from someplace else. Like, can you imagine the long knives going to be out for you? It's going to be hell on wheels. But if you can get in there for a couple of years and make some...
If you get a, you know, some kind of a CEO in there from a big company, I mean, somebody who doesn't need the money, you know, it could
be
great.
But again, the history, we're all celebrating that Baker's filed this bill, and I think we should. It wasn't that long ago. They're destroying records over there.
Kidding. I mean,
this is beyond all the overtime stuff that everybody listening has heard about and read about. I mean, it was like rogue agency.
But the other thing is, I think, you know, for the vast majority of state troopers that are really working hard and doing their job and they're not stealing and they're not defrauding anybody, you look at the state police now and you think, gee, I wonder if that's one of the guys.
You can't help it.
You can't help it. And I think it really hurts
that's
them.
That's a great point.
You think they're all in on it.
You do.
And the first question I want to ask. Hey, by the way.
Are you one?
Yeah, that's right. When they pull you over.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think you necessarily want to ask them that when they
you
pull you over.
You don't know me, Marjorie.
So can we move to something a little bit closer to home, even though encounters with the state police is pretty close to home with me, I should say. But that's for enough.
You've had several.
I've had a few. But,
just last week.
It wasn't last week.
Logan Airport.
I heard about that one. It was almost Thanksgiving.
Someone was dragged out of the car.
That was perfect, Jim. And I was on your side on that one.
They tried to drag him out, but
what was that officer's name again?
Graham. No, I don't want to name names, but it was Officer Trooper Graham.
Okay,
so iHeartMedia, they buy BZ. Yes. Well, they own a ton of stuff around the country. They buy BZ Radio.
Stations.
They do?
855.
They buy BZ Radio
in
2017,
yes,
is
2017.
That right? So what's going on right now?
So they had that big swap out with Intercom and all that. So by the beginning of 2018, they've got 855 stations and $20 billion worth of debt. So they start doing all this restructuring to try to like make their company look more attractive. So one of the things they did this week, they're down to about $8 billion debt, by the way, but they wanted to reorganize it more. So this week they announced that they were laying off one-third of their workforce. Now, for anybody who thinks, oh, well, who cares? That's what I'll tell you what this is really
huge.
All about. It's about losing touch with your local community. People should realize how lucky they are, frankly, having WGBH and another public radio station in town. We do a lot of, this is a local show, we do a lot of local news, we have local talk
shows.
They are very lucky because in other parts of the country, they got rid of whole groups of people. In fact, Phil Rado, who runs our station, told me this morning that in Boise, they got rid of four on-air people. There was such a backlash there, such a huge community outcry because they didn't want to, you know, have the whole thing homogenized and generified, which meant they were going to bring in voices from other iHeart stations. That were just, they call it a spoke in a wheel. So it's just like you're hearing the same people everywhere you go. They didn't want that in Boise, so they ended up hiring the people back. Now, locally, they did not whack Dan Ray. They did not whack Maddie Siegel. And if they had, I think we might have seen the same thing. Maddie Siegel is hilarious. He's saying, oh, well, he says, they're not going to bother with me. He says, I'm on my deathbed anyway. They're just going to wait for me. It's so funny, but seriously.
This is Maddie in the morning.
And meanwhile,
Maddie
is going on and on about how he got a text from management saying you can't talk about this. Talks about it all day long. It's like perfect. But the point of the matter is, the bigger issue is, people will be really upset if this catches on and there's no... I mean, BZ is a really good local news station.
We've all listened to her for 35 years. Yes, and you hear her. You don't want to lose touch with these.
They did take a hit on John Keller, but lucky for John Keller.
His commentary.
He really works for TV.
Yeah.
But he did those commentaries for, 25 years? Something like that.
More, maybe 30. But
And
by the way, I've stolen from a lot of those commentaries, so it's going to be a problem.
Oh, we all steal from him. And by the way, that's how you know what time it is. It's 8:56 a.m. when John Keller... That's
5:56.
Yeah, 5:56.
Can I tell you something? I'm so glad you brought this up. I had no idea this was happening yesterday morning. I got up at 5-ish, and I'm listening to BZ for 5 minutes. I switched to three stations in the morning to listen, and I hear this report I'm going to sound like I'm giving myself more credit than I deserve. It was so weird and so out of place. It was some national story, and they do national stories, obviously. And I even knew from that, first of all, it was longer than ordinarily, and I listened to it, and I said, boy, this didn't
out
work,
of place.
Whatever it was. I open, I go online,
yep.
And I see what happened.
Reason.
This is
this
what
piece
you,
of
get.
Generic
you get. This
news.
Homogenized, yep. Exactly.
Bicycled
generic.
Around to all these
but can
other...
I say, let me just say something hopeful about this, if I may. By the way, just out a couple of people, we used to work with Jenny Brophy in Country. She's one of the people
yes,
who
was.
Lost her
oh.
job.
She's a station
oh.
manager at...
Well,
Kiss
I think
108.
She was at a different place. Now she's at the Bull, as it's
oh.
called. 101. Well, she was. She is gone.
Yep.
The overnight host was fired. But the hopeful part of this is, I was doing a little research this morning. I know you. I'm sure you know this yep. better than I. Years and years and years ago, one of the greatest talk show hosts ever, David Brudnoy, lost mm-hmm. his job at BZ. People went nuts. He was taken back. The overnight host, whose name I can't remember, about 10 years
LaBelle.
Ago, Steve LaBelle. Was fired. The listeners
with him.
Went nuts. I went nuts, and he was rehired.
Right.
When iHeart came in 2017, there was this effort, a
yes.
fight-back effort to make sure there weren't layoffs. So as sad as this is, my understanding is there's another effort to save WBZ 1030, and listeners, if they care about this, are going to rise up and
yeah,
be heard.
I mean,
maybe something will happen.
You know, they've already genericized it to the point where there's only a few recognizable voices anyway. You know, Gary LaPierre died, unfortunately, so there's not, it doesn't have.
Well, he had left kind of, long before.
No,
he,
I know.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
he
yeah.
used to, you used to hear his voice, though.
That's true. Mostly on ads,
commercials,
by the way.
So what?
Exactly,
yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. And as I said, I think if they go after Maddie Siegel and Billy Costa, then.
I don't think that's.
Or Dan Ray, even.
I don't think that's.
I mean, those
either.
People make money for the stations, and. That's one of the reasons why they don't take them out.
In any case, so the reason you're here, other than to talk about things like this, would be this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
Yes, you do. So what is it?
All right, I already had to tip my hand because you guys wanted to talk about debate moderators. But my list today is tips. For debate moderators.
Oh,
very good.
Tips for debate moderators. Great. And a few tips for the candidates while I'm at it.
Go.
Okay? Number one, don't read your questions like it's the first time you've
so
seen
quiet.
It. Jim, Marjorie, we've all done...
I've done that.
No, look into the camera. Just, these people going, and I am wondering
so
if you...
Right.
It's like, oh, I mean, I've done interviews for 1,000 years. You can get the question. And by the way, if you stumble over a word or two, that's human.
That's what... I agree with
oh, Jim,
every
I
syllable.
I just went crazy when I see that. Also makes me mad. Here are these people up on national TV. I could have done it without reading a question.
Well, by the way, in all fairness, Abby Phillip hasn't
oh
done
God.
Debates before.
I could.
The
Wolf
pressure's
Blitzer's
on.
Done them for 30 years.
Terrible.
I've read questions.
I agree. Go
all
ahead,
right.
next.
Don't assert something is true when that's the question you're asking, like Abby Phillip
oh,
did.
Oh, that was bad.
I know you said, oh, she misspoke. She had it written down. And by the way, my guess is that CNN told her to put it that way because they broke the story that Bernie Sanders allegedly said a woman can't be elected president, and they wanted her to affirm that in their reporting.
But this is right after Bernie Sanders said again, I didn't do it. She turns to Elizabeth Warren.
That's not the question. The question is what Bernie just said
exactly.
true?
Exactly.
So she's
it's because she was reading it.
She was reading it, but she was also asserting something instead of asking
a
question.
Next.
Don't try to be the smartest kid in class. When that's what the viewers...
Excuse me.
Oh, my God. I can't stand that. When they go on and on with parenthetical phrases and then... And by the way... No, that's like,
okay.
Oh, my gosh.
She's nailing us, you know. I read my questions and you're the smartest kid in the room.
Okay,
this is you and me doing debates.
Don't be unnecessarily shocking for the sake of making yourself the star. Who can ever forget... Bernard Shaw saying to Mike Dukakis,
Governor,
if your wife Kitty was raped and murdered, would you still be against the death penalty? And of course, his answer was the worst thing in America.
Worst.
I mean, I would have said, what a hideous thing for you to conjure up, Bernie. But as long as you have. But no, I mean, it was unnecessarily
yeah.
shocking
why
and
did
provocative.
He even, do we know why he even asked that?
Because
well, it was
would,
a death penalty question.
Yeah, and have shock value.
Yeah, but throwing
value.
In your family.
Well, that's
is a little
that's
odd.
What he should have said.
Yeah.
That's repulsive
yeah.
of you to
next.
Throw in my. All right, ask a question everybody wants the answer to. This is why I appreciated Megyn Kelly, who I know took a lot of heat
I
for that.
Agree.
But she,
was great.
You know,
the woman question to Trump.
He had said vile things about women regularly, made fun of people's appearances. Even when Carly Fiorina was running, he said, well, could you vote for somebody with a face like that, suggesting she had a face like that? That was a legitimate question. Not for shock value, I didn't think. Thought it was fair. All right. Let the candidates finish without that. Oh, my God, Jim, that clock thing. If they would just let them go over for a few seconds, and sometimes there's a great exchange that's going on, they got to figure out a way to let that. That's what a debate is.
Can I say something quickly? Yes. In our own defense, we will be doing the first Kennedy-Markey debate. By the way, Liz Reardon dropped out this morning.
Yes, she did.
We'll do it
that's
on February 18th.
We do easier.
Not have, we do not have time
I know you
limits.
Don't. And I love that.
It's okay. Conversational.
And you're going to allow
I can't read
it,
my
it will be conversation.
Go ahead next.
No. All right. Here are a few tips for the candidates.
We only have a minute.
Don't try to be funny when you're not. Who could forget that unfortunate Shannon O'Brien answer to the
I liked
the tattoo.
Part, I thought it was. I liked it.
It went over like a lead balloon,
it did.
As you know.
I liked it.
Don't run over your allotment every time.
Klobuchar,
like Amy Klobuchar. It's. By the way, if you really have something important to say and you want to be heard with it, keep going. But just to eat up more time than everybody
I'm
else,
with you.
I found that really annoying. All right, and finally, my tip to the candidates: answer the question. I had a little paraphrase there, but answer the question. And stop saying, look it, look, and so.
And don't stare at the camera.
So
Tom Steyer, your favorite candidate. Now, before you tell us what you're doing tonight, Marjorie, tell Emily what your first question. Marjorie was a panelist in the Curry Weld debates of the 1990s. What was your first question to John Curry?
Why doesn't anybody like you, Senator?
That's a good one.
I thought it was good.
That's what everybody wanted to hear.
I thought it was good.
What are you doing tonight at 7 o'clock, Emily Rooney?
We got a bunch. We are looking at the debate stuff and iHeart, but we're also looking at, you know, The Athletic broke that MLB story about the sign stealing in November, and it was almost like it snuck up and took everybody by surprise in the local media, in the Boston press, everywhere, Houston press. We're sort of trying to figure out why. Mm. What, I mean, was it that well kept a secret, or did, you know?
Who broke it?
The Athletic.
The Athletic.
That's that website that's stealing all the best. You know,
I didn't,
sports
I've never
reporters
even heard of it.
It's a hassle.
Steve
to get
Buckley's
on.
There now, right?
Yes, and it's a real pain to get on their site. They've got a firewall up. You got to buy the thing, but it's a really well done site.
Okay, Emily Rooney, that
enjoy
was great
the
as
orange.
Always.
Nice to
love
see you.
The list.
So excited.
Love the list. Emily joins us every Friday. You can keep up with her on Friday nights right here on WGBH2 at 7 o'clock for Beat the Press. Thank you, Emily. Up next, December was Encore Casino's best month ever. Is this a fluke, or will it have an encore performance? The Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung is here for that and more on 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. At MIT, it looks like the buck doesn't stop anywhere, particularly if that buck, or rather hundreds of thousands of them, come from Jeffrey Epstein. Join us to talk about her latest report on MIT and how no one wanted to say no to Epstein's tainted money is Shirley Leung. Shirley is the Boston Globe's business columnist and, of course, a GBH contributor. Hi, Shirley. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, Shirley Leung, you've done great stuff on this MIT mess with Jeffrey Epstein, arguing in a column the other day that the president of MIT should quit. And now you're talking about MIT's chairman of the board. What'd you say about him?
I said he should also quit because now President Reif's defense is that I was unaware, contemporaneously unaware of the Epstein donations. And the investigation found that, but three members of his senior team knew, and they went out of their way to hide the money and to make it anonymous and secret. But they didn't, allegedly, they did not tell the president, and he did not approve these donations. But it's a different story with Chairman Miller. Chairman Bob Miller, I don't know if you can say it's buried in the report, but the report's 61 pages. This was done by the law firm Goodwin Procter on the Epstein situation. And starting around page 40, there's four pages about Chairman Miller. And up until the report was out, we didn't know about Chairman Miller's role in this. And it turns out that MIT Media Lab Joey Ito, who was kind of the ringleader in terms of trying to cultivate Epstein as a donor, had gone to Chairman Miller, spent significant time with him, trying to convince Miller to help Ito bring in Epstein as a major donor, or at least help him bring his friends in. And I, as I wrote, there were multiple times where Miller could have stopped this in the tracks and said, or even raised a question of, should we be accepting money from Jeffrey Epstein? Should I say something to President Reif? Because the chairman of the board is perhaps the most powerful man on campus. I mean, Reif reports to the chairman of the board. But none of that happened. And so I wrote about, and his defense is that it's not his job, Millard's job, to tell the university administration who they can accept money from. That's too small of a detail.
What did former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger, who's this one of his areas of expertise is this, how did he respond to that assertion by Millard?
He responded, he said, listen, he said to me, Millard is not just anybody. He's the chairman of the board. He sets the tone for the institution. And in my piece, I also, kind of further explain that that this is not a minor detail this very act of deciding whether or not MIT should cultivate Epstein as a donor gets to the core of the chairman's job.
By the way, we should have said Epstein was a convicted
sex offender. Yes.
We forgot to say that.
Yes.
He killed himself in prison, and he was awaiting charges on many more instances of sex with underage.
Exactly.
Say sex with underage girls. I should say sex crimes against underage girls.
Sex trafficking thank you. So what happened was, so I say that the chairman's job, making this decision, goes to the core of his job, which is shaping the values and the mission of the institution. And Harshbarger said to me, listen, it's clear to him, whether it was Reif or President Reif or Chairman Millard, nobody wanted to ask too many questions about Jeffrey Epstein. Everybody looked the other way.
Well, let me say a couple things about that. But first of all, your reporting is relentless and so needed on this. Good for you. That's one. Two, the fact that Millard, on an issue this important to MIT and this community, chose to, email or some crap, this, you know how I feel about this kind of thing, have a conversation about something like this rather than sitting with your consultants in your audience in your office and deciding how to respond. But I want to go back to your original story, which I think you did later the same day you were with us last time, the Reif thing. You cite passages from the 61-page report that you read, this speaking to Reif allegedly not having any idea what's going on. Quote, other members of the senior team, including Reif, have no recollection of discussion of Epstein in any senior team meeting, but they do not rule out the possibility that such a discussion happened. Next, President Reif wrote, Epstein, Joey Ito, in his copy of the agenda for the April 28, 2015 meeting. At his interview, Reif could not recall why he made this note on his copy of the agenda. And then on August 26, 2019, coincidentally 2 weeks after Epstein allegedly killed himself, Reif noted in an email to Vice President and Secretary of the Corporation, I don't remember anyone saying anything about what Epstein was convicted for and served prison for, on and on. So even if this is not beyond a reasonable doubt that he did know it, I think you raised, and the report raises, huge questions that he's got to answer in a much more public way if he wants to survive.
Well, you know what I wondered? Well, first of all, how many women were in high places at MIT?
Readers have asked me that question.
Yeah.
I think that I don't know. And I know that the three senior team members who kept the secret about Epstein were all men. There are women in the administration.
I can't help wondering if Epstein had been convicted of a different kind of crime, like burning down a house or attempting to kill his neighbor, or anti-Semitic graffiti. Well, I don't know if he was he Jewish. I don't know if he was Jewish, but anti-Semitic graffiti, something like that.
How about molesting little boys instead of underage girls?
I think there's something here about the lack of seriousness about sex crimes against women. I mean, we see this over and over again. These were girls, which is even worse. But you know what I'm saying?
No, I agree. When you read the report, a lot of the whistleblowers, a lot of the people who felt uncomfortable about MIT accepting money for Epstein were women, whether they were in the development office or at the lab.
I always wonder when a columnist in town, Marjorie in her former life, you now, really take on a major institution. how much blowback is there from the institution, either to your boss, to a Brian McGrory, to a John Henry, to you? I mean, what kind of response are you?
You know, this is really, I got this question a lot this past week. Has MIT gotten on the phone and started yelling at me?
Yeah.
And they have not. I don't think that's their style. Then I'm like frantically checking my voicemail. Do I have bad voicemails? And then I went to Brian McGrory, my boss,
the editor of the paper.
I said,
have
you heard from MIT? And he said, no.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, so we'll see today. We'll see what happens today. So,
in any case, it's hugely important, and I want to compliment you for taking
this on. Thank you.
It's
and I think there will be more shoes to drop on the story.
Oh, good. So, Marjorie, by the way, Marjorie and I fight before shows, and we're talking about with Chelsea about what we're going to talk about on the show. Anytime I bring up casinos, Marjorie says, nobody cares about casinos. Thank God you are not.
I'm not.
I am obsessed with this. So, we have more new numbers on Plainville the slots joint, MGM Springfield, and on Encore. What did we learn?
Plain Ridge and MGM had really bad. Were they the worst?
Worst months they've had
worst
since
months.
They opened. Yeah.
But Encore did better. Come on. Encore had a really good month in December. And so, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about casinos today is because. Another reason is because of MGM Springfield. My colleague Michael Silverman wrote a story about how they're re-examining their business model. Right now, you think of it as going to MGM Springfield as gambling, and it looks like they want to do some more sports events or driven.
They're doing
a bunch
this
of
winter weekend with the Red Sox. Talk about timing,
right,
by the way.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. After with the Red Sox.
Right.
And the notion is that entertainment, and by the way, this is what they talked about, even though Encore doesn't have much entertainment either, that for major destination casinos, that entertainment, sports entertainment, are the lure, and when people get there, they're likely to gamble more.
Well, not only that, in this story by your colleague, Michael Silverman, he talks about how in Las Vegas, MGM, which owns a whole lot of casinos out there, that gets 70% of its revenue from non-gaming activity.
I'm not surprised by that.
70%. It's huge.
It's already pretty big. I think it's almost 50% already here because it's food. Food, hotel, all that stuff. But I always thought that we kind of... I guess I want to say the casino executives are smarter than we think. You know, they know they're coming into a saturated market, and they just have to keep pivoting and pivoting and make money in different way, because they do have this big facility that they've built, and they have restaurants, and people need to be entertained. And one of the things they're betting on is sports betting and kind of a sports theme beyond kind of these hosting these winter baseball talks.
Which is now legal, by the way, in New Hampshire as of a week or so ago, and I think a week or in Rhode Island.
Right.
And as we discussed with Deb Goldberg yesterday, even though she doesn't appear to be crazy about it, her contention, who's head of the, obviously, lottery as treasurer, is if they're going to do it on our bordering states, we should be doing it here. But I have a couple of things just quickly to say before we move on, so Marjorie doesn't yawn in our faces. Encore, despite having a good month in terms of revenue, comparatively speaking, it appears that they are part of the problem for Plainville and for Springfield.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's one. Two, there's another report somewhere that they're 200 down in employees and there are 1,000 people below their goals. When you said, you know, they have to keep changing their business plan, it seems the business plan for a casino when you go to a gaming commission is artificially inflate every number in terms of jobs. And by the way, still a lot of jobs, still a lot of revenue, but artificially inflate numbers of revenue and jobs so that you get approved, and then you come back in and say, I'm serious, you say, well, we didn't meet our goals,
but now
we're going to rejigger our work plan.
I don't think it's just the casino industry that does that.
Well, that's probably true. And but keep in mind, were we having this discussion with you last week about the Southeast thing, that they're at least...
Yes,
and your contention is they should at least look at it, which they should. But part of the problem is here is not just too many casinos in Massachusetts. The Connecticut casinos, two of them, are close to Springfield. In the Southeast, we have all the Rhode Island stuff.
New York is really built up now.
Coach Shelley Adelson, the kid from Dorchester, is worth $1 trillion now, who didn't bid to begin with, who said the market's going to be oversaturated. Three is too many, and I think we're learning three is too many. So I hope the Gaming Commission goes really treads lightly
as
the
it
Southeast.
Decides
yes.
what it's going to do
Absolutely.
In terms of more.
Well, also the other issue now is, you know, Plain Ridge wants table games.
Yeah, I know that, yeah. Which and have been a boon, apparently, to Encore, which has
right.
been a surprise. Have you been back to Encore?
When did I go there? I haven't gone there lately, but I want to go for Chinese New Year. Because
they have a special Chinese
New Year? Usually in Vegas they do, and so I was curious. Chinese New Year's next weekend, so yeah. I actually have to find out. But I should go back. I should go back in the next month.
So let's talk about a problem that I didn't even know about till a few
this
years
one
ago.
Marjorie
now
cares
it's getting
about.
Worse and worse. I do care, but this is terrible. That all around the country, birds are flying into glass buildings, and your colleague at the Globe, Dan McGowan, wrote this really upsetting piece about a building down at Brown University in Providence where they're finding dead birds every
right.
morning outside yeah. of this glass building, and they don't right. really have a solution.
Didn't we discuss this with you
we
in
did.
The Boston
this,
context
we had, remember,
a couple
yeah,
years
Tim
ago?
Tim Logan did
yes,
a story.
Did.
One of
yeah.
my favorite stories yeah. ever about the well, it has to do with like bird migration, the way they build buildings. It's in Dan's story, it was the energy efficiency of the building, and
yeah.
so. But there are some solutions.
Well, they can turn off the lights.
Right, turn off the lights
at night,
and they're going to try some kind of stain on the windows.
Yeah.
But I think it sounds like it happens when they migrate. You know, they're where
but listen
buildings.
To this. This in this story. It says it's a 2014 study, and that was 6 years ago, published by this ornithological journal. I got that
Ooh,
out.
Oh, you did.
Between 365 and 985 million birds are
yes.
killed every
I can't believe your memory.
Year.
We brought this up when we discussed the
yes.
problem in Boston with Shirley
yes.
a couple of years
yes.
ago. We both said that's not possible. And you went back and confirmed that
yes.
these are real numbers, well, up
yes.
to a billion
and,
birds.
But you know what my favorite stat is?
What?
Is that it's, what is it? It's second only. It's so they're tracking unnatural deaths, and it's second only to cat
Cats.
Pilots.
Well,
to cat true. Attacks.
But you know what else? With pesticides and climate change, we think back to Rachel Carson's Silent
yeah.
Spring a million years ago when she wrote her book in the late 50s and early 60s. I believe that's when it was. I mean, she was talking about birds. Silent Spring, there was going to be no birds singing
yeah.
outside your house. And this, when you think of the glass buildings and they're everywhere,
yeah.
the cats, what are we going to do about that? I guess you're supposed to leave your cats inside. My cat, I remember, well, anybody's had cats.
You don't have a
outside.
Cat.
I had cats growing up.
You
and
did?
Every, yes.
I had cats I growing
that.
Up.
And
they love
morning,
birds. They love
every
killing
morning,
birds.
They'd be like, yeah. but they have to come show you the damn
exactly.
dead bird.
Exactly. They love to bring the bird in the house.
They leave it on the, or the doorstep.
right.
You know, there's the bird. There's the squirrel. It was disgusting.
You know, one time my cat brought a bird in, and it wasn't
dead.
Oh.
It started flying around
oh,
the house.
God. Oh, God. And the way they torture these animals is disgusting. But anyway, and pesticides and the bees.
Yeah.
I mean, we are like... We're in big trouble. So I hope they do something. They said in the story.
I think they do have solutions because it's not an isolated.
Glazing,
yeah, it's not an isolated incident.
Putting something in the window, turning off the lights, and some ultraviolet liquid.
Yeah, that they just so that you know the birds, you know. Don't
obviously, neither of them
avoid.
Have any idea what they're talking about. It's pretty obvious
well,
they're
it's
BSing on that one.
It's a problem. It's a problem.
It is
it's
a problem.
Problem.
We know
it's
yeah.
a problem. It's a problem in Boston. It's a problem
okay,
in Providence.
Fine. Now,
birds.
Talk about problems.
I mean, do you want to have a silent spring? Do you want to wake up in the morning
okay,
and hear
fine.
No birds?
Marjorie,
I mean, I'm really upset about it.
Can we talk about a problem where Shirley apparently has found
yes.
a solution? We all know that disposable coffee cups, and you and I are practically coffee addicts, me in particular, but you're pretty close,
Marjorie. With your disposable coffee cup in front of you right now.
Exactly. However, not for long, because you have written about this Boston startup called the Coffee Cup Collective, and actually one of the participating companies is Flower, where I go every single
yeah.
day.
I
so what is the Coffee Cup Collective, and how does it work?
So I started this story, or I became interested in disposable coffee cups from starting last fall when I wrote a story about Honeydew switching from foam to paper cups. But in the
plastic lined paper.
Right. So
yep.
in the course of reporting, I learned that even though it's much better to use paper cups than foam, these coffee cups, whether it's Starbucks or Dunkin' or Honeydew, these coffee cups, paper coffee cups, are lined with plastic because that's how you keep, you know, the liquid from seeping, insulated.
Right,
yeah. And so those are nearly impossible to recycle. And so you're really not saving the planet by switching to a disposable paper cup because there's no capacity to recycle them.
And as you point out, all the toxins.
Right,
from
and
the
some people point out, there's some you know, if you talk to the Conservation Law Foundation, they'll say that these plastics, you are ingesting some of these toxins.
Yeah.
And so ever since then, I've never looked at a disposable paper cup the same way. Mm-hmm. So around the time my story appeared in the fall, Coffee Cup Collected had just started their beta launch. And what they do is I rent a stainless steel cup from them for $3.99 a month. So they're participating cafes. So Render is a coffee shop that's down the street from the Globe in the Financial District. So if I want a cup of coffee, I download the app. Mm-hmm. I order a cup of coffee, I get 25 cents off because I'm using my own coffee cup. They bring me one of the beautiful stainless steel cups, which is like double walled. It's hefty. I get my coffee and I can drink it there, or I can even take it back with me to the office as long as I return the cup in 7 days. So I signed up for the I can use the service 5 times a month.
And if you want to drink more, though, you can pay up to $9.99
for unlimited. Yeah. So right now, Coffee Cup Collective is now expanding to Flower. They're doing 2 locations in Flower right now, one in the Seaport, one in Cambridgeport. And so it's a really great idea. And it turns out it's not the only outfit doing this. There are other players nationally. I think this might be the only one locally. Flower Bakery, I talked to the operations manager. He's really excited about this. He really wants to roll it across all 8 locations because they've been trying hard to reduce their waste with their containers.
Can I ask you one question about the mechanics of this? I know I read in your story you have to return the thing within 7 days. But assuming you go, let's say, to another Flower, or what's the other place called? Render?
A Render, right.
In the interim. Or you go back to the same place and
right.
you forgot it.
Right.
You can get another one, but you just can't hold any of them more than 7 days. Is that true or not?
I think I can hold 2 at a time,
okay.
But I'm not sure. So let's say I drink the cup at Render, right? But let's say I'm near a Flower that has this. I could drop it off at Flower.
Oh, you
so,
can? Oh,
yeah,
that's
so
great.
You can. So because
oh, that's
the
good.
It's the
and they don't have you don't have to wash them.
No, that's
which is
the
a big
yeah,
thing.
Don't, right.
No.
You don't have to wash.
You just bring back the dirty cup.
Right. So Allison Rogers is this like 29-year-old founder of the company,
I love that.
and she was working at the EPA a few years ago. And she was upset. She would go to Starbucks 3 times a day, and then she would leave this trail of trash. And so she was thinking, how do I solve this problem? And so she thought about, basically, it's a system, what they call circular economy, where you share these reusable cups. And if you think about now, bike sharing, that's what we do.
Yeah.
Right? So the cups are tracked through an app. And so that's how she knows, or how the company knows that I have
that's
it out for
great.
A week. But it's great. I'm hoping it takes off. At the very least, it'll just inspire people. Like now, I wanted a cup of coffee here today. I was thinking like, oh, but I want to bring. I should have brought my own.
Well,
cup.
Well, you do feel crummy about it, and you know, you think this isn't a big deal, but as you point out in your story, Flower Bakery, just Flower Bakery.
Right.
They say they go through 1.6 million. Disposable cups a year.
Yeah.
So imagine how many Dunkin' Donuts,
right.
that's a massive thing, or Starbucks goes.
Well,
goes
there is a research group that does track this. They said Americans consume nearly 120 billion cups of disposable coffee a year.
That's a lot
of cups in the
me.
Old landfill, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And most of them, like 99%, are not recyclable.
Well, you know, by the way, even if things are recyclable, with China not taking
it.
What was recyclable? Right, the cities and towns in the Globe
right.
the other day.
Yeah, I have zero.
They're
I
not
have
even
very
recycling
little. When I throw something in the recycling bin today, I have very little confidence that it actually get recycled.
You know, imagine if the president were on board with climate change, then when he's negotiating with the Chinese over this and that, he could negotiate to take some more of our. of our coffee cups that are recyclable. Anyway, Shirley Young, thank you very much, as always, for coming.
I think we should talk to Lev Parnas about that and see if Lev can bring it up with Rudy, who can bring it, whatever.
Thanks for having me.
Again, congratulations on the MIT stuff.
Thank
Just
you.
Yeah,
great.
It's been great. Boston Globe business columnist and WGBH contributor Shirley Young joins us every week. Thank you very much, Shirley. Coming up, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley joins us to talk about her latest trip to MCI Norfolk, what we need to do for more meaningful criminal justice reform, and a video posted yesterday that's getting coast-to-coast attention. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In our ongoing fight for equality and equity, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, along with other members of the Black Congressional Caucus, went to MCI Norfolk to meet with the men behind the wall. She joins us to talk about how engaging with prisoners there informs and inspires her push for dramatic criminal justice reform. We're also going to talk about how she is truly giving public service new meaning by going public about, well, actually, we'll let her tell you what she's going public about in a video that is powerful for its candor, its compassion, and that is being talked about all over this country. Congresswoman Pressley, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to see you. Happy New Year. Happy New Decade.
Yes.
You all are looking great, so you're already living up to those New Year's resolutions.
That's
right.
That's right.
All right.
Absolutely.
Good stuff.
I had two sandwiches for lunch, but it's a special day because you're here.
Other than that, well, Congresswoman Pressley, Jim just mentioned this video that a lot of us were watching yesterday, and I commend you for your honesty and your courage, really. But tell people about the video that is everybody's talking about all across the country. You know, the Washington Post, you're everywhere.
Okay, so yesterday I became presented a video where I went public with the fact that I'm living with alopecia, which is an autoimmune disease, a skin disease where your immune system attacks all of your hair follicles. And the reason why I decided to go public with it is, you know, the fact that I had been wearing my hair in braids for a number of years meant a lot to a lot of people. It's not often that you see women of color in spaces that have traditionally been more conservative wearing their hair in what many would consider to be an ethno or Afrocentric hairstyle. But in my community, it's just a protective hairstyle. It's a way of protecting your natural hair. And my wearing my hair in these Senegalese twists and braids had become this really conflated part of my personal identity as well as my political brand. And little girls were writing me from throughout the globe to say how much it meant to them. Just the power of the representation. You know, mommy, she wears her hair like I wear mine. And there were T-shirts that had been created that said, my congresswoman wears braids. And so I felt that the fact that I was in enduring a very private battle required that I be public about it because my presentation had changed. And I felt that I owed all those little girls an explanation. But the other thing is, and this is not just true for my alopecia, living with alopecia, but I do believe in general that I'm here to not just occupy space, but to create it. And I've done that as a survivor of sexual violence. I've done that in a host of ways. And I think that's what's incumbent upon all of us in positions of leadership. There's nothing extraordinary about me. I don't think I did anything exceptionally brave yesterday. I don't, because it's my story, but it is the story of millions who know the trauma and the personal pain of hair loss, whether because of chemotherapy and cancer, whether because of genetics and heredity, whether because of alopecia. And it's, I have a new squad now, the Bald Squad. And and all of these people living with alopecia, men and women alike, who have experienced hair loss, have been reaching out and saying, welcome to the alopecia family. I talked to a little girl who is 11, was diagnosed at 9. She has totalis like I do, which means it very quickly accelerated, and she went to total baldness. And she said she thinks she can teach me a thing or two. She said she just went to school and told her peers, I'm bald, but I'm still me. And, you know, so I really have been humbled and overwhelmed by the outpouring of support. And in the same way that we created space for millions when I wore my hair in braids, I did not realize the extent to which that would be true when it comes to hair loss.
So I want to spend one more minute on this before we get to criminal justice. I rarely tell a congressperson on the show, you are dead wrong, but you were dead wrong. When you said it was nothing brave, let's not.
I didn't feel
that. Having said that, the timing, when you talk in this, I hope people go to The Root and check out this video if they haven't seen it, 7 minutes long. When did you describe the final pieces of hair of yours fall out? What was the timing for that?
Well, it was an inflection point not only in my life but for the country. So I had been for weeks working creatively to conceal this rapid hair loss, baldness. And that was stressful in and of itself. And then the night before I was to cast a vote in support of impeachment articles, I went completely bald. I was in the privacy of my home alone. I took several bathroom selfies. I sent them to my husband, who has been an extraordinary partner throughout what has been a really transformative, disruptive life event, not of my own choosing. And he assured me that I was beautiful. And I was grateful for that. But in a matter of hours, I was going to have to go onto a public stage, into the House floor. And I did not think I could go onto the House floor bald without an explanation. And some people have said, why is this a big deal? What's political about this? Well, I'm a woman, I'm black, and I'm in a public space. Everything I do is political, even if that's not my intention. And so if I had just gone to the floor bald, I think people would have thought I was making a statement. And so we worked creatively with a hairstylist to customize a wig for me, and then I had to go out on the House floor, and I'll just close here and say that I was wearing boots, tights, a skirt, a shirt, a jacket, a belt, and this wig. And I'd never felt more vulnerable or more naked in my life, and embarrassed and ashamed. But I had to lean in and stand in the moment because I had to go and make the case for articles of impeachment.
Wow. That's all I can say. We're talking to Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. And once again, you rarely make film recommendations. Go watch the video and do it soon.
Okay, let's move on to what you've been doing in regarding criminal justice reform. You went to MCI Norfolk with a delegation. You're very involved in the bill about criminal justice reform, but tell us what happened, what you did at MCI Norfolk.
Sure. Well, let me just backtrack for a second and say that throughout my run for Congress, I said that the people closest to the pain should be closest to the power, driving and informing the policymaking. And, you know, that isn't just some slogan. That's a lived practice and a value along with myself and my dedicated A-team. And so in my first year in Congress, I've introduced 30 bills. I've co-sponsored almost 400 pieces of legislation. I've written and passed about 10 amendments. And I have not cast, and I've cast 700 plus votes, right? So there is not a vote that I've cast, a bill that I've written, an amendment that I've authored, a bill that I've co-sponsored, that I was not directly informed by those closest to and most impacted by the issue. And so that is certainly true and continued for the issue of what I call transforming our criminal legal system. And so the Congressional Black Caucus, which was a historic visit, for history purposes, the Massachusetts delegation had two African-American members in the Senate, Ed Brooke, who was the first black attorney general elected, and then the first United States senator. And then after him, we had Mo Cowan, the esteemed Mo Cowan, who was appointed by Deval Patrick. But we have never had a person of color, an African-American, a black woman, to represent the Massachusetts delegation in the House of Representatives in its 230-year history. So this fly-in, the CBC fly-in, was historic because I'm a first, and so this is a first.
They had never been to Boston. Is that correct?
As a contingent.
So right. There
are CBC fly-ins, Congressional Black Caucus fly-ins. Now, again, there are 54 members in the Congressional Black Caucus out of our 200-plus member Democratic caucus, and out of our 436-member Congress. The Congressional Black Caucus is often referenced as the conscience of the Congress. So the CBC fly-in that I organized was consistent with the fly-ins that have been taking place throughout the country to assess the state of black America. And we went behind the wall of MCI Norfolk because, again, on the issue of criminal reforming our criminal legal system, transforming it, I want to engage those most impacted. And so there are a cohort of men there with incredible acumen about the law and about government and lawmaking. It's a contingent of men called the AACC, the African American Coalition Committee. These are men that I worked with during my campaign. In fact, they had organized from behind behind the wall a minimum of 3 family members to go to the polls and to vote. They endorsed my candidacy. They endorsed Rachel Rollins' candidacy. So they are very civically engaged, politically minded. And so, one, we went there because I was going to keep my promise. I promised them that I would return if I was fortunate enough to be elected. And so this has been, this was my third visit with them. I promised I'd come back with the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. I did not know I would have 5 other colleagues in tow with me. And so it was incredibly powerful. And so what was centered in that meeting was my People's Justice Guarantee Resolution, something that I've introduced to usher in a paradigm shift, something transformative. I think that our criminal legal system is so fundamentally flawed and broken that it cannot be reformed by tinkering at the edges, that we need a transformative, a bold, radical reimagining of what the criminal legal system can be by prioritizing decarceration. The 1994 crime bill prioritized and incentivized mass incarceration. And I don't believe we're any safer. When people say to me, but what of the public safety? No one wakes up and wants to be a victim. And I don't believe anyone wakes up or was born to be a perpetrator. Okay? I think that, you know, all of us deserve to live in a community and a society that is safe, where we can be healthy and where we can thrive. And as someone who grew up with an incarcerated parent, I think that's an important perspective to offer here as well. My father was in and out of the criminal legal system for 14 years. Now, my father is a brilliant man, okay? But my father was battling, like millions of Americans, substance abuse disorder and opioid addiction specifically. He committed crimes to support his addiction. He committed crimes, but my father was no criminal. What my father deserved was on-demand, culturally competent treatment to address the traumas that resulted in his self-medicating. Prison should be the last stop, not the first. And so by decriminalizing poverty, decriminalizing homelessness, low-level offenses, why would we ever lock somebody up for evading a public transit fare? Particularly if they're experiencing homelessness and trying to get to their shelter bed before it closes. So by decriminalizing poverty, homelessness, and low-level offenses, and disease like that of what my father experienced, we think we can get to 80% plus decarceration. And finally, my father went on to attain 2 advanced degrees, to become a professor of journalism and a published author. So that is what is possible when we make the investments in true reform and rehabilitation.
You know, we've gotten a taste of this, obviously. That was a huge part of what you're talking about, Congresswoman, is what Rachel Rollins ran upon. Got a mere 80% of the vote elected to Suffolk County DA. But break that down for us. Tell us what some of the key elements of this plan that you put together are.
So the People's Justice Guarantee Resolution, again, is a bold, transformative, radical reimagining of our criminal legal system. And some of the top lines of it call for, you know, certainly sentencing reform, abolishing the death penalty, doing away with juvenile detention facilities, abolishing private prisons. Because as unjust as our criminal legal system has been, it has also been incredibly profitable. And so this is also something that we aim to address, is the and then finally, 2 pieces of legislation that I've rolled out to begin to codify the tenets of the People's Justice Guarantee Resolution, and that is to end the school to confinement pathway, which is growing disproportionately for girls of color. In Boston, black girls are 6 times more likely than their white peers to be disciplined, suspended, or expelled for the same infractions as their white peers. Black girls are losing classroom time because people say their hair is distracting. You know, their hair is being criminalized. Their bodies are being criminalized. And it is putting them on a pathway to the school to confinement, to incarceration. That is just not acceptable. And then finally, doing away with the death penalty. Now, in Massachusetts, we don't have the death penalty. What we do have is life imprisonment without parole, which might as well be the death penalty. So when I am meeting a graying population behind the wall of people who committed offenses when they were 17, 18, 19 years of age, and now they have gotten, and they have schooled, they have been self-taught, and have a lot to contribute the members of the CBC were so impressed with the level of acumen and facilitation. They said that it exceeded that of what they've experienced in corporate boardrooms. And so we need the benefit of that intellectual capital out here. And also, we're spending a great deal of money. I mean, $50,000 per incarcerated man or woman. And so if they no longer pose a threat to society, you know, why are they behind the wall?
Can I pick up on that number thing? You know, ordinarily, my reaction, if you had done this 5 years ago, would be, say, this is great, you care about equity, care about compassion, you have no chance. What it seems to me, what we've lived through in the last handful of years is this odd sort of coalition between the right and the left, for lack of a better expression, with progressives concerned going at it from the direction you're going, where
Thank
conservatives
you.
Are worried about that $50,000 a year, are worried about the huge cost of being the most incarcerating
right.
nation in the world.
Absolutely.
So there is some potential
yes.
for
and,
bipartisanship
and that is
here,
why
yes?
we were able, you know, there was legislation that was advanced, that was bipartisan, to begin to speak to this. And now we're just offering something. That was a first step.
The first step
legislation. But now we're offering, and I think there's a paradigm shift, to your point, Jim, happening in the country. We're really at an inflection point where we reject the idea that people will be any less safe if we are just more compassionate and smarter about how we go about reform, rehabilitation. I mean, as an example, one of the things that we prioritize is an investment in supporting people in their reentry into society. How can you, in good conscience, tell people, we want you to go out and make a positive contribution? Jim, Marjorie, they're being released, 30% of them, to shelters. So if we know that the number one driver of recidivism is unemployment, it is disingenuous when people can't even, the affordable housing crisis is real for everyone. However, those that have quarries, who have served their time, face great discrimination, both in housing and employment, although they are desperate to make a positive, legitimate contribution to society. So we're really looking at this issue holistically. And then finally, in the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District, 1 in 4 children are like me, and they have an incarcerated loved one or caregiver. And so we know that this is resulting in family separation and the decimation of community.
You know something, Congressman Presley, you mentioned that your dad was in and out of prison, that he went on to have contribute greatly in his life. But what was that like for you as a kid? I mean, it's tough to talk about your dad being in jail. It's tough to go visit dad in jail because they make you feel like a criminal yourself coming in to visit dad in jail. What was that like?
Sure. I felt the social stigma of having an incarcerated loved one. And I felt a resentment and hurt like millions of children who have parents that battle addiction. You have resentment in that you feel that they've chosen their addiction over your family. And so, yes, it was very destabilizing on our household. But again, I've been transparent in telling my story and my father's story and how it impacted our family, because we're not anomalies. You know, Jim McGovern and I just introduced legislation to support this new family model that has emerged, and that is grand families, and to incentivize HUD, Housing and Urban Development, to use the power of the person to provide grants to support grand families in their housing. Who am I talking about? Grandparents raising grandchildren. That is at an epidemic. We have this new family model because of this public health crisis and epidemic that is opioid addiction, that is substance abuse disorder, because of mass incarceration, because of poverty, because of the number of people that are serving in the military right now. So there's a residual sort of domino effect in all of these things. But again, 1 in 4 children in the Massachusetts 7th is a child like I was and has an incarcerated loved one or caregiver.
So you read some of the headlines about the prison system in Massachusetts. Prison system fails to process inmate health care requests promptly. Families had to stay at house to fight for lower phone rates because they have these exorbitant phone rates. You can't even afford to call your families at home. The ACLU is suing the state for denying inmates medication that they need for their drug addiction. Last year at MCI Norfolk, we all read about the fact that prisoners were drinking water that smelled bad and looked like black tea, and they thought it was filled with stuff that was causing neurological disorders. Have they cleaned up the water yet at MCI Norfolk, or are they still drinking out of bottles down there?
Well, I can't speak to that, but what I will say is that my priority is decarceration, and then secondarily is prison reform, and then third is successful reintegration and reentry. Because of my own experience, I'm very focused on how do we maintain those familial bonds while a loved one is incarcerated without families going bankrupt, right? And then how do we, because that has become, again, it's profitable,
yeah,
right?
Phone calls.
It's profitable. And then on that note, because I wouldn't be doing my job if I did not talk to everyone about the 2020 census. And I want to tell you something unconscionable, that incarcerated men and women are being counted in the census. This is prison gerrymandering, according to where they are being warehoused. And correctional facilities are by and large in suburban communities. And so these communities are getting an allocation of federal investment when I believe that those dollars should be going to the home communities that those incarcerated men and women are coming from, which have often contributed to an ecosystem that would put them on a pathway to the criminal legal system and to incarceration. And that's unacceptable. One of the other things we talk about in the People's Justice Guarantee Resolution is incarcerated men and women having access to the ballot. You know, because this is these are a number of folks that have already been disenfranchised, and then you know, probably one of the incarcerated men had said that it is the greatest civil injustice and sanction to then further disenfranchise people and deny them access to the ballot.
You know, one related thing I just want to mention before we leave the topic. I don't know if you've read Martha Minow's book, former dean of head of Harvard Law School, When Should Law Forgive? But she was on a couple of weeks ago with us, and I was thinking about it because when you mentioned bankruptcy, in this brilliant piece she writes about forgiveness in criminal cases, why is it, because you mentioned the word bankruptcy, Congresswoman, why is it on the civil side of the law we think it's okay to forgive, meaning if you have debts, it's okay, even though most people who get bankruptcy are the Donald Trumps of the world. Why have we not been able to forgive and in this process of decarcerating, as you call it, on the criminal side? It's brilliant writing, brilliant thinking. It so naturally fits, in my opinion, into
and
the direction
you're
going.
And to that end, I just want to say something that I think is because it's so easy in debates around very complex issues that we need to be considering through an intersectional lens and more comprehensively, that these things get boiled down to just one digestible soundbite, okay? Again, I don't think anyone is born to or wakes up wanting to be a victim or to be a perpetrator, okay? And I'm in no way saying that if someone has committed a crime, that they should not serve their time. But what we want is equal application of the law. And that has not happened. So that's why we call for sentencing reform, because we see that there are disparities mm-hmm. in sentencing for the same crimes. In the same way that I said that in our school system, that in Boston, black girls are six times more likely to be disciplined, suspended, or expelled, it's not because black girls are behaving more badly than their white peers. It's that they are being disciplined differently for the same infractions. And so all we're looking for here is one, to center and prioritize dignity, safety, equality, freedom, shared power. We want a criminal legal system that centers humanity and dignity, and we want equal application of the law when it comes to sentencing and when it comes to treatment. And then we want to make those formidable investments for those who have served their time to make sure that they can successfully reenter and reintegrate into society, to make the contribution that they desire and seek to make, to play a role in stopping other young people from going down a similar pathway. And right now, that is not happening.
You know, one last thing on this. I don't know if you saw a criticism of you in something called Law Enforcement Today by some correctional officers' organizations. And I thought of this because of what you said a minute ago. You're not arguing that people shouldn't pay a price for what they've done. Their criticism of you was, and I'll boil it down, even though it was much less respectful than this, I should say, and I think intentionally not understanding what you were about there, that you cared more about people who'd committed crimes than corrections officers, including some who had been physically assaulted at MCI Norfolk. What do you say to those people?
I'm so glad you asked that question. First of all, You know, I come from a family of law enforcement. A little well-known fact, my mother actually went through the police academy in Ohio, which is where my mother was born and raised, Cincinnati. So I come from a family of law enforcement, and I have tremendous respect for those who make it their business to keep the peace. And one of the things the People's Justice Guarantee Resolution calls for are trauma-informed services and access to behavioral health services, both for correction officers and also for those who are incarcerated. Here's what I'm saying. If the environment is not safe, no one thrives. I don't want COs feeling unsafe. I don't want incarcerated men and women feeling unsafe. Everyone deserves to have the dignity to have their humanity centered, and to be safe, whether it's at their place of work, in a cell, in their home, in community. And so I don't tier the value of anyone. I have tremendous respect for and gratitude for those that are in law enforcement. Again, what we're looking for here is just a complete shift of culture, and that includes one that supports an ecosystem where everyone feels safe.
You know, Congresswoman, you mentioned before that you went in to make the vote for the impeachment, and you were dealing with the alopecia and all the concern about that. Of course, you did vote. Now we're facing a trial in the Senate. I'm wondering, for those people who are a little discouraged, because many people just think this is going to be a rubber stamp by the Senate and the president will be acquitted, do you have any hope for those who are worried, or how do you, I mean...
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah. Here's the thing. You know, I've been supportive of pursuing articles of impeachment, or an impeachment investigation or inquiry since April. And not because I went to Congress to impeach a president. You know, this is nothing to be celebratory about. I have a sobered heart about why we need to do this, but also a resolved one. Because of the people in this district who have experienced real fear and fragility and compounded hurt. When it comes to the Trump administration and their policies, the cruelty is the point. And when it comes to their culture, the corruption and the chaos is the point. And so I believe we have put forward a very tight case. And as you see, we continue to have, I think, more revealings that are coming out that confirm what we know, is that the corruption is pervasive. The Mueller report did not get us to a place of impeachment. But don't forget that people were indicted and sentenced, and it really did speak to the pervasive nature of culture. I personally believe the Mueller report did prove obstruction of justice. And we have had too many instances of abuse of power and authority. Look, you guys, I serve on the Oversight and Reform Committee. And the level of obstruction, evading, and stonewalling has been unprecedented. They have tried to hamstring Congress from doing our job as patriots, not a partisan pursuit. The truth is not partisan. You know, preserving our democracy, this is not about Donald Trump. This is about the office of the presidency, and that we cannot endorse the lawlessness that has taken place there. Now, so far as the Senate is concerned, let me just say this. If you believe that he's innocent, then why wouldn't you support documents and witnesses to support an alibi? If they move to dismissal or acquittal, then what that reads to me is cover up. And I'm going to sleep well at night, because I know this Democratic majority Congress did our job. And whether Donald J. Trump likes it or not, he has forever been impeached. That will not change.
You know, before you go, I know you have only 1 minute left, but I'm watching this video of you last night, and part of the video is you walk into the lectern to make your speech. And it's like an out-of-body experience for me to some degree. Not so many years ago, we were talking about Ayanna Pressley voting on a plastic bag ban.
Yes.
Or an
Or
an electrified manhole cover. Do you say, I mean, when you're walking, what is the feeling when you're only 3 times in American history has an individual had an opportunity to vote on impeaching a president of the United States? You're gone from what you did. I'm not minimizing the importance of being a city councilor to walking down to the lectern to say you're about to vote?
What can I say, Jim?
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It has been quite a year. I was onboarded in this 116th class, which is unprecedented in its representation and diversity, in the midst of a federal government shutdown. At the one-year mark almost of my serving in Congress, I voted on articles of impeachment. I went bald. I returned to Congress in the midst of us potentially being on the precipice of war. And so I do just want to say, to go back to this, on the issue of our criminal legal system, to me, it's not that dissimilar from the debate I'm trying to have now in Congress around foreign policy. I reject binary choices that we have to choose between peace and security. I believe that we can have both. And I reject the binary choices of pitting groups against one another. I care about the safety of everyone. This is just about equal application of the law and the acknowledgement that our destinies and our freedoms are tied. And we need to center the humanity and dignity of our fellow neighbors wherever we are. But I feel humbled. I feel grateful. This is surreal. I feel that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. And if it's not obvious, I love what I do. I am so honored to be able to be doing it.
I think it's obvious. I think it's obvious,
Congresswoman. It's great to see
Thank
you.
Thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Congresswoman
Thank you for having me.
Is a Democrat representing the 7th Congressional District. Coming up, how calling out the Oscars for its diversity problem is an age-old tradition. Callie Crossley takes us back to the days predating hashtag. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy, Marjorie. Doesn't it feel like a tornado just blew through here, Marjorie?
Yeah, really.
Wow.
She's a powerhouse.
Joining us as she does every Friday is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. That, of course, is Callie Crossley. Callie, wow. What do you think of that?
Well, fabulous, and I have to follow. Great. Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
But I'm dying to know what you thought, because I watched the Congresswoman's video yesterday, and, you know, it brought me to near tears. I
mean, oh,
it was so honest and so vulnerable.
Absolutely. And then, I've received many, many messages from all kinds of folks. I was just sharing with the Congresswoman that people said, do you know her? I said, yes, I do. Please give her a hug, because they were feeling very emotional and grateful that she revealed so personal a part of her, that it really is a story of for a lot of other black women, and that the reason that she did it is she wanted to be honest with those little girls that look up to her. I mean, you just can't say more than
can
that.
Can I just say, can we step back from this for a second, even though we do want to get to, you know, in 11 o'clock today, we did an hour on opioids and related things with the mayor and some of his colleagues, where Marty Walsh speaks openly, as he has, and painfully honestly, about his alcoholism, his non-recovery, then his recovery, which I think does huge things for people who are struggling with the same things. Then we have Ayanna Pressley, also representing Boston, just in another forum, with honesty. I mean, I could not get near either of those things if I had lived through what either of them had.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, in my opinion, the courage they both show, whether you like their politics or don't like their politics. What that does for other people who are suffering with whatever, when you hear people of that stature have the courage to talk about the most intimate and painful things, is huge. And I really compliment both of them
and then you,
in
and
immeasurable
then,
ways.
Yes, I agree with you. And then you realize that you have the great honor to be a platform for which these people can reveal some of these stories, and that's important as well.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Good to see you, Kelly.
Good to see you.
So let's move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
The 2019 Teacher of the Year from Minnesota takes a knee at this game that the president and the first lady attended last week.
Yeah, just when you think that people have forgotten about Colin Kaepernick's protests, this Teacher of the Year, she's the Teacher of the Year from Minnesota, Kelly Holstein, she was at a gathering of a lot of Teachers of the Year from around the country at this game, the National Football League Players game, and spoke with her other colleagues and said, I feel very strongly that I'm going to take a knee at the game to protest. And they said, we understand, we don't disagree with you, we're not going to join you, but we support you. And she did it, but the important thing was, for the context, and that is that the President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump were at the game as honored guests. We should say that this article pointed out that another Teacher of the Year, it reminded us, had actually gone to the White House after she got the honor, gave out all of her materials, and did her protest to his face in the White House and said, yeah, I'm not agreeing with any of this stuff that you're doing, and here's why. Here's my buttons. Here's my, you know, my arguments against some of the stuff that you're doing, very respectfully, but she chose that method. So,
who's that remind you of, historically?
Going to present...
Going, having the courage to go to the White House and raising an issue
so many
you care
people.
About. Well,
there's a
famous person we talked to, I think with you about it. Was it Eartha Kitt we talked about? A few months ago,
I think we had
that conversation?
There's a lot of people who've chosen to do that, you know, and I admire them. You know, so many of these courageous steps that people do, I think to myself, I would be in my room with the door closed.
Amen.
You know?
I'm so glad you said that.
You know,
so would I.
Under the bed.
Pathetically, you know, and I just, anyway. So.
Eartha Kitt paid a huge price, too, for going
right.
to the White House.
Well everybody's. I mean, I'm sure that this teacher is going to pay some price as well as did the other one. I mean, I just think that when you've decided that I have a statement to make and I'm going to do it respectfully and the circumstance is not going to make me veer from the commitment I've made to my protest, hey, what can I say?
You know, we talked to Jared about this in another capacity a couple of days ago. I mean, a lot of people in America are talking about it. It was Oscars So White, was it 2015, I think?
Yes.
And it's Oscars Still So White.
Yes.
In 2020, and I have to say, as troubling as that is, I hope, for a lot of people, did you see what Stephen King, who I'm a great admirer of, not just as Stephen King, beyond being one of the great writers of all time, Stephen King tweeted, and he's a liberal, something about diversity should have nothing to do with this, and I hope I'm not misinterpreting what he had to say, but there's been a huge storm of blowback for him, the implication being, I think, that diversity and quality are separate
notions. Right, which
notions.
Just makes me crazy.
And he's so missed the mark for a guy who, in my opinion, is so often on mark. But in any case, what'd you make of it?
You could respond to this. I think this is why we have this situation, because there's a lot of people that are older and white and male in the Academy who don't even think about this.
Well, they don't, and it may be sort of an automatic thing to just say, not that she was in the running this year, but for example, Meryl Streep is in, for sure she's getting it. I mean, of course, who would argue with her? But there were a lot of other fine performances that other people in the community, I'm not even talking about those of us outside of the community, I'm not talking about those of us who are the consuming public, though we should have some weight on it for these kinds of awards, but the people in the industry pointed out all along, here are these fantastic performances, and just to not have them considered is really crazy. And by the way, the new hashtag is Oscar So White, So Many White Men. It's a long one, but you know, because of the director's thing, and you know, it's just it's really disheartening when you know you've done really, really fine work, extraordinary work. Others of your peers have acknowledged that, and then you get to this award thing and, you know, it's sort of back to the traditionalists or following some stereotypical lines. So, for example, for the movie The Parasite, you know, the movie got all kinds of awards. The director got a nod. following in the all-male category, but none of the actors. And this is an ongoing trend against Asian actors, similar to Awkwafina wins a Golden Globe, but where is she, you know, in contention for Oscars, not to mention Sandra Oh has been looked over I don't know how many times. So that's the kind of thing that makes me distressed. I do want to say this. There's a lot of focus on the acting awards and the directing awards, and I'm going to go to one of the smaller awards that I'm very excited about.
What?
It's the animated short, and there are, of course, 5 nominees, and there are 3 persons of color in that category, 2 Asian women, and 1 other product by a Matthew Cherry, who is a former football player. Speaking of hair, his piece is called Hair Love, and it's an animated, it's gorgeous and so touching, animated short about a black father doing his daughter's hair for the first time.
I heard about this.
It was a GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy raised all the money from everybody else, and now he's, you know, gotten an Oscar nomination. And as I said, there are 2 other young Asian women in that category as well. So that's kind of hopeful. And I'm hoping that in some of the other categories that have not been talked about, there may be some other signs of hope.
Well, we should say, well, I want to play one soundbite, which I just love because I love Trevor Noah. There was one person of color nominated for one of the primary acting awards. That was Cynthia Erivo.
Yes.
For in Harriet.
Yes.
And here is what, and I thought this, but I couldn't articulate it. And of course, the brilliant Trevor Noah said it 1,000 times better.
Okay, let's hear it.
Here is Trevor Noah commenting on the recognition of Cynthia Erivo.
I mean, I'm glad that at least one black woman was nominated for Best Actress. Congratulations, Cynthia Erivo. That's exciting. Although, it is kind of predictable that it was for playing a slave. Yeah. And I'm not saying she didn't deserve it, but just imagine if every white actor who was nominated got it for playing a supervisor at Whole Foods. People, you're more than just that.
Does that nail it?
He is so clever.
He is so clever.
He is very clever.
And for people who haven't read it, his autobiography
is fabulous.
Fantastic. Growing up in apartheid in South Africa is absolutely
fabulous.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, Kelly Crossley, there was a moment of absolute panic when all of Boston learned that Tom Brady and Giselle had moved out of their house in Brooklyn. And not only that, Giselle apparently moved out of the suite at Gillette Stadium where she watches Tom play.
Yeah.
But it turned out...
One reporter is saying that's just not true. And I think it's fascinating. Now, what I don't understand is the suite at the Foxborough, is it cleaned out or not? Nobody is clear about that. They say that the reason it's not true is that because they don't have a house in Connecticut. Now, I'm just going to say this.
What?
A few weeks ago, you recall, many people said the Obamas had purchased a house, and the savvy realtor said, they don't have a house. They bought a house here. And then weeks later, they had. So, just saying.
Martha's Vineyard.
That's right.
They don't
have a house yet. Could
we
be.
Know.
We don't know. But in fact, the reporter that said they, in fact, do not own a house, so they could not have moved into one yet, is correct at this point, apparently.
Do you care about this, by the way?
Oh, no. I think they are big cheaters. So, you know.
Whoa.
Oh, no. I'm a big cheater.
But
who are we talking? I mean, you're going from Red Sox to...
I all across the board. I've been saying it for years. Nobody likes me in the newsroom.
Wow. You mean you're talking about local teams?
I'm talking about... Don't you remember when Tom Brady smashed up his phone?
I do.
Okay, hello.
Was that part of Deflategate? That was Deflategate,
thank
not
you.
Spygate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Wow.
No. But I do think that, you know, from a cultural impact, from a, from a community and a cultural impact, what he does is important. So I pay attention to it.
You know that you're about 100 feet away from TB12 right across
I know what it
there.
Is. I know. No nightshades. Even though your guest is coming on. Her last name is Nightshade.
That is exactly correct.
You know, no nightshade vegetables. I know that. So. Okay. I know the rap. I just, you know, that's my feeling.
Okay, we're a little bit short on time today, Kelly Crossley. So we got to go. What are you doing on your television show, your radio show, Sunday nights right here on WGBH?
Well, as you know, Monday is the celebration of Martin Luther King. He would be 91 this year. So we're doing a show, the first part of our show, we're looking at his legacy with voting rights. That's on the line so many places because of Supreme Court decisions and also targeted voter suppression. And so we have 2 excellent scholars to break down where how the history links to what is actually happening today, and very specifically about some of the things that are happening today, and whether or not at the end they believe that King's legacy with regard to voting rights has been shredded. So that's the first part of the show. The bottom half is the MFA. Last summer started a program with these teens of color, teaching them how to be curators. And so the teen curators have a big show which premieres on Martin Luther King Day called Black Histories, Black Futures. They each curated their own collections. They learned, spent time with curators. They're very much into art now. One of the kids said to me, I never knew I'd like art. I like art. I'm into it now. And
what do you
I got
mean
a tour.
Curate? They select different paintings?
Yes, from the 20th century artists of color in the collection of the museum, in addition to a few pieces from the Philadelphia Museum of Art and a couple of other places, but mostly from the Museum of Fine Art's own 20th century collection of artists of color. And
wow.
They have very good reasons for why they themed each of their collections, why they did that, what they selected, what they now see in each piece, how you look at a piece when you're curating
That's
a piece
great.
And learn about
that.
Art. It's fabulous.
You know, before you go, you
mentioned... And it'll be up till 2021, so...
You mentioned the King thing. I just want to promote something we're doing, too, is when... Monday, obviously, is King Day, and the reverends will be with us, Price and Monroe. And we're going to talk about somebody who was there with King through a lot of this, John Lewis, who obviously is in the news of late, unfortunately, because of a cancer diagnosis.
And I interviewed him for Eyes on the Prize.
And I interviewed him in 2015 at Kennedy Library. Yes. I was so nervous. Talk about nervous. Yes. I'm so excited.
Yes.
And a teenager when he met King, 23
That's
years
right.
old when he spoke at the March on Washington. I mean, and really the last living... high-profile person from that moment.
And I think you also need to talk about how he had to be talked out of doing the very volatile speech he wanted to give.
At the march, you're
talking
about,
at the March on Washington. He was a young person with a lot of attitude. And said,
when you said King would have been 91, I was thinking how young he was.
Oh, yeah.
Well, 26 when he moved to Montgomery. 26 years
26.
Old. So when you talk to these young people who are very much committed to the causes that are important to them now, you can't say you're too young to know, because he was 26. Nobody knew. He wasn't MLK capital letters then. Nobody knew what he had going at that point. And look what came of that. So,
Callie, thank you
very much.
Callie,
it's great to see you.
Absolutely.
Callie Crossley is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Thanks again, Callie.
See you, Callie.
Up next, it is time for our Friday news quiz with the brains behind the old school game show. What's that? We're going to find out next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
No, we haven't changed our theme song. You'll hear why we're doing that in a minute. This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for our Friday News Quiz. We're joined by Mike D'Angelo and Ginny Nightshade, the dynamic duo behind Old School Game Show. It's part game show, part theater, with a generous helping of live music and sketch comedy along the way. Mike is the creator, host, and star of Old School Game Show. Hello, Mike. It's nice to see you again.
Great to see you, too, Jim.
And Ginny, who is his partner in production and life now, we'll talk about that, too, is a fixture in the Boston burlesque scene. They're here to... Ginny, it's great to see you again, by the way.
Yeah,
thanks for coming
back.
Thanks
for having us.
They're here to preview their new season, their continued residency at the American Repertory Theater's Oberon, where you can catch their Valentine's-themed episode on February 15th. Welcome back to both of you.
Yeah, thanks so
thank
much.
You.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having us back.
Okay, so elaborate a little bit on what Jim said. What, if Describe the old school game show, either of you.
Okay, so it's a live, interactive, theatrical experience.
What does interactive mean? It makes me nervous.
I know. It does make you nervous. So the good thing I want to tell you is that it's a 70s-style game show where people submit their name to come up and play, you don't have to submit your
name. Goodness.
You can sit back, relax, watch the show. It's fully scripted sketch comedy, a huge live band, a musical guest, which is usually a local musician. And I think we can announce our special guest.
It's very exciting.
So
Brandi Blaise recently performed at the Boston Music Awards. She's going to be our Valentine's Day guest.
Oh. Yeah.
Super excited
so
to have her on the show.
So she'll do two songs with our house band, and then throughout all of that, we're playing trivia with the audience.
Actual
so we
live
call
game
them up,
show,
there's
Price
a buzzer,
right style, yeah.
And they win prizes.
So what percentage of people volunteer to be participating in this? This gives me hives, by the way.
I know.
Of participating.
I'm
the same way. I think, you know, usually the first timers, they usually just want, you know, I'm not going to put their name in the official fishbowl that we draw the names from. And they just, you know, they just want to see it and kind of, you know, have a fun time.
Yeah.
And see what it's like. And then it's usually those folks at the end of the show, I talked to them and they said, This was great. I am definitely putting my name in next time. I was nervous. I didn't know exactly what to expect.
Yep.
But, yeah, I'm doing it. We give away great prizes. They see that it's really just a lot of fun. It's really not about getting the answer right or wrong. It's kind
of,
you know, it's a party that we're having up there. We're welcoming.
Can I tell you something? I don't want to give you advice, but I'm going to give you advice.
Please do.
You don't know how to pitch this thing at all.
Okay.
I'm tell you
this is why I'm here. I thought this was
exactly.
a branding
please
meeting that we were
exactly.
doing.
Exactly. Go ahead,
let's spitball some ideas.
Pitch it as Jenny did, as this exciting whatever the hell it was game show with live music and 70s and participants. You pitch it as you're looking for a life partner. Come on down.
That also happens. I thought that was naturally implied.
That is
exactly what happened.
That's true. And it is
Wait,
our
is
Valentine's
that really true?
Episode.
That is
Did you really meet
true.
As part of this deal, or is that made
yes,
up?
Yes, I went to see the show, and I was so amazed by the production. I asked to be a part of it.
That's right. We met. Actually, it was the first Valentine's special that she was
was
an actress.
It?
She was.
Oh.
She played the part of Dream Girl.
Of course, she
was. And then, you know, she
there
is my dream girl, my
real
life dream girl.
I wore roller skates.
There you go,
in the park.
We had our first kiss on stage.
Whoa.
She says it doesn't count as the first kiss because it's on stage.
Exactly.
Oh. More of
How
a,
was that, by the way?
It was fine.
Not
no,
great.
It was,
it was not. Anyone who's done a stage kiss, it's more of really a face eating, a frenzied
yes,
face eating
yes,
than a stage
yes,
kiss.
Yes.
But and then we got engaged on stage.
He
we got married
on stage.
On stage.
Oh
my
God.
At the Oberon.
On
you know, we've decided we want to do every significant life event on stage because
I hope
we
not.
Are damaged people and
exactly.
we desperately crave attention.
Now,
so thank you so much
quiz.
For having us on.
So
you'll second.
Be giving birth on stage.
That's what he says.
Well,
someday.
In the last Valentine's special as part of the storyline, we took
did,
the next logical step and
we
conceived our child
on stage
in front of the audience.
As part of the show.
We were worried it might be a little weird, you know, with the audience there, but they were sweethearts. It was very
They
natural.
Loved it.
Yeah.
So I have one more thing before we start the quiz. I hope you don't take this the wrong way, Mike.
No, I love these. I love how he just hangs these.
But,
you know,
Jenny, he
yes.
is rather
preambles.
Odd.
Yes.
And he is.
Yes.
A lovable weirdo.
So your
yes.
first
my
impression,
wife
I know you went the first time, you ended up marrying him. That's your business.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's for you and your therapist to figure out, really.
What was
I don't
your first impression when you saw him on the stage at your... when you went to see this
my first impression I mean he's an incredible performer. He's surprise surprise in our real life a very quiet thoughtful man. He is but on stage he is kind of a tornado of a human and apparently that is what I'm into.
Okay.
So here we are.
Reach his own, right?
We all win. Yeah, I won.
I understand why you were her, but
yes.
the whole thing
Jimmy,
thing,
didn't
I don't
you see. Tell me that when you the first time you were there he collapsed on stage
he did.
From dehydration
he did back
yeah.
at
Great.
Before I got involved as his co-producer, the show was a little reckless and wild.
It was
and
a one-man operation.
Nobody was hydrating, and there was no organization.
Staying up through the night,
Michael
writing the games and the sketches myself. And
they rushed him to the emergency room from the theater. That hasn't happened since.
In my weirdly patterned blazers
put that in my
and
resume.
Alarmingly tight pants in the emergency room.
No, I couldn't resist you under those circumstances either,
right?
Mike. Let me tell you.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you. All right. The love affair begins
exactly.
right
now
here.
Now, we are talking to the man. Man and woman behind the famous old school game show.
Thank
it
you.
Is February 15th at the Oberon. The Oberon is great, by the way. If
yeah,
you've not been, O'Brien. It's the ART's deal right outside, well, the edge of Harvard Square. It's just fabulous.
They're great.
Let's start the quiz and embarrass the two people from the old school
game show. We'll start girl, girl. Ready, Ginny? I'll start with you.
Okay.
Okay, question one. Diego the Tortoise is finally retiring from what? A, being the champion racer in worldwide tortoise racing.
Okay.
B, saving the Española giant tortoise population thanks to his rampant sex drive. Or C, being a therapy pet at the San Francisco airport.
Okay, B, he is the sexy turtle.
You knew that.
Right?
The
sexy turtle. I saw that on Facebook.
By the way, I want you to know Diego the Tortoise is willing to give birth during the show.
During
on
it's
the
happening.
Stage.
You guys heard it here first.
Oh, wait. He's coming for my job, you're saying? I don't.
Is that something you can technically retire from? I didn't know that would be.
Yeah.
It's a very fine point.
Excellent point. Okay.
Did you read this? Who's flown to the Galapagos Island in 76 when there were just over a dozen giant tortoises?
Yeah.
He went on to father 800
offspring.
That's a legacy.
What a guy.
That's a legacy.
He's a busy guy.
Okay, Mike, you're losing 1-0. Here's your chance to redeem yourself.
Right.
Because sometimes you all need reminders. Japanese instrument manufacturer Yamaha had to release a statement this week advising customers to not do what? A, not to use their instrument cases to try and smuggle yourself out of the country. B, not to stick your head inside the mouth of their tubas. They can get stuck. Or C, not to start that new age synthetic band called Synthesthesia, like whatever it is, that you've always been talking about. Don't ask me to repeat it. Which one is it?
Don't start a synth band.
The third one was very abstract.
Yes.
I think it was just a word poem.
Is it A, B, or C there?
So I don't think it's that one. I'm going to say it's not that one. It's either A or B. Mm. I work in the music industry.
You do?
So I really got to get this one here.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, wait, I have already confused which one was which, but it's the one about smuggling yourself
correct.
A case.
Ding, ding, ding.
You
and you get an extra quarter of a point if you know why that was the warning. What happened about smuggling and an instrument case that caused them to put out that warning?
Well, is it suffocation? Is it a...
Ding, 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 no.
No.
Okay. How about you? Do you know the answer?
I don't.
I thought you would know
this. I mean, I know I don't know his name. There's a guy, and they put him in the...
Give her a tenth of a point for that. That's close
There's
enough.
A guy?
The guy?
Well,
no,
a point.
Keep going.
This is a generous...
He was in trouble, and he was escaping the country, and so they, like...
Did he
got him on a private jet and
that's it.
Thing.
The guy from Nissan, the head of Nissan. Ding, 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 judges. Give her a tenth of a point for
that. I don't know his name.
Of the great
Who was it, though?
It was the head of Nissan. I don't remember his
Nissan.
Name, and he snuck out of the country and whatever.
Yeah, the guy in Massachusetts helped him out, apparently.
So it's 1-1/10 at the end of one round.
Okay, here we go. Question three. In a Supreme Court hearing this week, Chief Justice John Roberts uttered a recent popular phrase during the hearing enshrining it in SCOTUS history. What was it? A, ain't no laws when you're drinking White Claws. B, okay, boomer. Or C, frack it, dog, life's a risk.
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. Who is the person?
He's a Supreme Court Justice in the United States. He used this phrase during a hearing in the Supreme Court this week.
No, excuse me. What is this collaboration thing? No.
Competing.
No, this is a competition.
Yeah. Okay. Ain't no laws when you're drinking White Claws. Yeah. That's A. B is okay, boomer. C, frack it, dog, life's a risk. That's C.
I guess B, okay, boomer.
Very good. Yeah, Chief Justice John Roberts used that phrase while discussing an age discrimination case.
Okay, well, so he's very hip.
He's hip. He's hip.
Apparently he is. And he's quite a boomer, too. Now, you're losing 2-1/10.
Okay.
And amazingly, this question is worth 1-1/10. You can tie it up going to the bonus round. Gwyneth Paltrow, who we talk about almost every day, in her role as wellness guru, launched a product this week that is already sold out.
I'm really glad Mike got this.
This is true. What is it? A, to promote height, Paltrow released her line of unpasteurized giraffe milk. B, Paltrow is selling the letters M and D carved from tree meat to empower her wellness followers to be their own doctor of medicine. And C, Paltrow is selling a candle that is scented to smell like her vagina. Is it A, B, or C?
I know this answer.
Yeah, we were talking
answer
about this
because
in the
it
car.
Was a possible Christmas present.
Okay.
I was a little disappointed. It is the vagina scented candle.
Congratulations. Excellent.
That's right. Many will be lit at the next Valentine's
Probably
game
will.
Show.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you always wonder how she got. How she managed
the art. Not to a think team of scientists in a lab.
None of my business.
This is not quite right.
You know, Mike, before we get to the bonus round, how did this whole thing start?
How it also
no
it,
not you two the, oh, the yeah. old school game show
old school game show it actually started at a house party so oh. It was a game night gone a little wild mm-hmm. and I was asked to come in and kind of you know because I'm always been obsessed with games car games you know family of five so we're very competitive so I made my own games and it started just a house party. I have a lot of musician friends. They were there. They said this is great. We did a couple more and then they said let's do this live. We'll be your backing band. Did the first one. It was, I grew the mustache, didn't have a mustache then, had the name tags, and then it just kept snowballing.
The rest
and doing
is
myself and
then
met these amazing.
Along came Jenny Nightshame.
Along came Jenny Nightshame. Along came our head writer, Caitlin Buckley,
our announcer, Will Smalley.
All my
really
best friends
team.
Now, and I'm very lucky just from that yeah. house party and from that idea. You know, all the best things in my life came from that. So
yeah, we were mentioning before, 700 people at the Wilbur Theater.
The Wilbur.
So that's a pretty big audience, right?
Yep, yeah. And we pretty much always sell out at the Oberon now.
That's
so
great.
Please get your tickets if you want to come. Yeah.
By the way, how do they do that? Well, I guess we're saying that at the end, but where do you go?
Sure,
to get
you
tickets?
Can go to our website, oldschoolgameshow.com, and buy tickets right there on our ticket page.
Fabulous.
Okay
bonus round.
Oh, no.
Want to read the premise of the bonus round?
In the honor of our game show, Quiz Guest, the bonus round is compiled of Jeopardy questions that have bested Jeopardy greatest of all time winner Ken Jennings.
Okay.
So it's going to be really
no
hard
pressure.
To get
well, this no pressure,
choice,
right?
Okay.
okay, here we go. So we'll switch it up. I'll ask Mike the first one. Ready,
okay.
Mike?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. The closest country to Greenland is this one, a mere 16 miles away.
Oh,
is
God.
It A, Iceland, B, Canada, or C, Norway?
Oh, wow. Okay. This is a little bit of
a
blind spot
yes.
that I have anything
geography.
Useful or practical.
yeah.
Geography, anything that, you
it's
know.
Not pop
so,
culture,
yeah. Okay.
Movie.
So this is going to be a total guess. So it was about Greenland. I know the Beatles say
Greenland is closest to.
There we go. I know the Beatles when they came to America. Yeah. How do you find America? You take a left at Greenland. That does not help me with this answer.
No, it doesn't.
But come on, we
just
all love
pick,
the Beatles, don't we? And
pick.
I'm going to say Norway, Norwegian wood. I'm going to go on that Beatles that synesthesia
fabulous.
Thing.
Yes. Fabulous
that's a good
and
guess,
wrong,
but
okay.
it's not.
How about
do you want to try?
It's either Iceland or Canada.
Iceland.
Good guess. I would have thought.
I'll say Canada.
Yeah, Canada. That's correct. But
oh, that is correct.
Know,
so I get
that.
The points. Now, you ready, Jenny, for this or not?
I guess so.
I think it's pretty clear that Marjorie and I want you to win. So good
luck.
She destroyed me the last time we were on the show, guys.
Well, she's about to again.
It happened, you know. I still wake up in the middle of the night covered in sweat.
Well,
screaming about the last time.
In ancient Peru, only certain priestesses, as you well know, were allowed to brew this beverage they considered very sacred. You with me so far?
Yep.
Okay. Is it A, coffee?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
B,
wait a minute. Hold on a second.
Is it beer? Might be.
Okay.
Or C, is it kombucha?
No. Nope. No, it's not kombucha.
So which is it, A, B, or C?
I guess it's beer.
Beer. Excellent.
You are correct.
How'd you know? That is incredible.
We have a quiz show scandal in the making here right
maybe
now, guys.
Do
I don't want to.
Maybe we don't. So we only
time
have a minute.
For one
we
more?
Do. This okay. is you could tie it up maybe.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Really quick. Here we go, Mike. This is the measure of brightness of a celestial object. The sun's apparent one is more than -26. Okay. What's it called? A, luminosity, B, illuminance, or C, magnitude?
Psst. Okay, one of these is Mike. a
is the measure a. of brightness of like a star
a.
or the
one of these is like an underground organization
what's the
that
answer?
Kind of runs everything,
say
right?
A.
And I think now we're a part of it, maybe secretly. I don't know.
A.
The Illuminati, luminosity.
Well,
I'm gonna go with.
He's
oh, we picked
don't
A. That would be wrong. That is so
I'm
sad.
I'm sorry, Jim. I gotta stick to.
No, because you were trying to cheat, and I felt I had to expose you. You know, it's horrible.
He screwed you, Mike.
Okay,
so
that's
yeah,
it.
Right.
Game's
outrageous.
Over. Ginny wins.
That's
it.
Thank you very much.
Thank
okay.
you so much.
Thanks, you guys. You're great.
Okay.
As always.
Thank you.
Really
all right,
it.
We've been talking to Mike D'Angelo and Ginny Nightshade. They're the dynamic duo behind Old School Game Show. You can catch them at the Oberon for their special Valentine's themed show on February 15th. Here's the important info. To learn more, go to oldschoolgameshow.com. Mike and Ginny, thank
it's
you so
to
much.
Great to see you both.
Thank
you,
too.
Thanks,
you
were great.
And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in on Monday for our Politics Roundup. TV's Bob Thompson and the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price will be here for All Revved Up on Martin Luther King Day. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Henry Ubeli, Aidan Conley. Our engineer is John McClaw Parker, our on-site engineers, are David Cleckley and Eddie Hickey. Special thanks to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe. Everybody
thank you
came
all.
Down
we appreciate it.
To
thank
Boston
you.
Public Library. That means a lot to us, too.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes.
By the way, we had two incredible... The whole show was good today. Great hour with Mayor Marty Walsh on the opioid crisis and his colleagues. Incredible 30 minutes with Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman.
It was a nice
They'll
job,
They'll all
Jim.
Be online in a few hours. So go to WGBHnews.org if you missed them.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browder.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again on Monday and have a great weekend and stay warm.
See ya. Cubic zirconia dancers and that swinging band. Just began. Hey, what was that? You won't believe your eyes. You never know just who might be stopping by. When you've got it, you've got it. Only one way to know.